This episode of the Rick Emerson Show is made possible by our good friends at Squires Electric, a brand new business partner. Squires Electric is a full-service electrical contractor for all of your residential and commercial needs. You can contact them at 503-252-1609, or for more information, go to squireselectric.com.
One very familiar type of song is the Christmas Carol, although it is perhaps a bit out of season at this time. However, I am informed by my disc jockey friends, of whom I have none, that in order to get a song popular by Christmas time, you have to start plugging it well in advance. So here goes. It's always seemed to me, after all, that Christmas, with its spirit of giving, offers us all a wonderful opportunity each year to reflect on what we all most sincerely and deeply believe in. I refer, of course, to money. And yet none of the Christmas carols that you hear on the radio or in the street even attempts to capture the true spirit of Christmas as we celebrate it in the United States. That is to say, the commercial spirit. So I should like to offer the following Christmas carol for next year as being perhaps a bit more appropriate.
Christmas time is here, by golly, disapproval would be folly. Deck the halls with hunks of holly, fill a cup and don't say when. Kill the turkeys, ducks, and chickens, mix the punch, drag out the dickens. Even though the prospect sickens, brother, here we go again. On Christmas Day, you can't get sore. Your fellow man you must adore. There's time to rob him all the more. The other 306 a tea of war. Relations, sparing no expense, send some useless old utensil or a matching pen and pencil. Just the thing I need. How nice. It doesn't matter how sincere it is, nor how heartfelt the spirit. Sentiment will not endear it. What's important is the price. Hark, the Herald Tribune sings, advertising wondrous things. God rest ye merry merchants, may ye make the Yuletide pay. Angels we have to go out and buy. Let the raucous sleigh bells jingle, hail our dear old friend Kris Kringle, driving his reindeer across the sky. Don't stand underneath when they fly by.
Minutes after the hour of one, and this the month of December in the year of our Lord 2010. Thank you for drawing near that ye might be amused and entertained on this Thursday. It is the Rick Emerson Radio Program from high atop the milk packing district in the heart of beautiful Southeast Portland, Oregon. We are live from the plushly appointed yet not overly ostentatious studios of the Emerson News Network. Thank you for joining us. It is Thursday, December 23rd, 2010. And welcome to Day 12, my friends. It is 503-505-6964. We would like to join us today from America and beyond. 503-505-6964. 503-505-6964. We would like to get on board with your comments, questions, clarifications, observations, ruminations, ponderings, amusements, banalities, trivialities, recipes, or what have ye. It is 503-505-6964. My name is Rick Emerson. I will be your host. I'm alongside Don Taylor, from whom we will hear more in just a moment. But first!
Maybe I want to talk now. Never, I'll just sit over
here. Is that how it's going to be? Is this setting the tone for the rest of today's show? Because I can play that game. I can rumble, sister. I can't really rumble that much, actually.
No.
You got a little food on you.
That's surprising.
Yeah.
That's a shock.
Here's the thing is, I didn't even really know that that was true when I said it. I was just trying to bluff. But then you did, actually, just right over here, like right above your right boob.
You were just trying to get me to touch my own breasts.
Yes. All right. Well, in any event, if you'd like to email, it's rick@rickemerson.com. I can't really do the sinister laugh. I've worked. You know who can do that is Cable Hashitani.
Oh, like, well, I'm not
nobody's
surprised.
Business. He can do the sinister laugh.
I think you have to start with bois.
Bwahaha.
Yeah, to make bwahaha. You have to start with a bois. Yeah.
Yeah,
a mois works very well too. That was much better.
Ah, there you go. You know what I sounded like just a little bit there to my. Are you having trouble opening your bottle of Viso?
The new Viso bottles, the lids are really, really tight. They're on really super tight.
Is this one of those moments where you get a small window into what it's going to be like when you're old?
Oh, yeah. Well, I already, you know, well, again, I got all arthritic, and so my hands aren't as strong as they used to. So I became a girl. As soon as I got, like, arthritis in my hands and my parts, I became a girl. And now it's like I'm always handing things to Patrick going, open this for me, won't you? And I feel like such a weenie.
Is it one? Would you like me to get one of those things from QVC that's like a rubberized whale or something?
And then I've thought about that.
You could use half of it to open, like, you know, like soda cans, and the other half to open your Dinty Moore beef stew come evening.
Yeah. Well, and the other problem that I also have at home is that whenever there's, like, a soda bottle or anything that has to be reclosed, Patrick cranks it shut.
Of course.
As if, like, it has, you know, acid in it that could spill over and like eat through the floor or something.
Or like the substance itself is going to fight for freedom and twist off its own cap and
yeah.
He has to secure it down with like a ratchet set.
Yeah.
And so forth. In any event, if you'd like to email, you can do that. It's rick@rickemerson.com. That is rick@rickemerson.com. If you want to engage with us electronically, Dawn can be reached. That is dawn@rickemerson.com. Dawn, D-A-W-N, dawn@rickemerson.com. You can also Skype if you'd like. That's Rick Emerson Show is our Skype name, Rick Emerson Show, with the text box is open and so forth. By the way, in response to an email I just got, the opening song you heard there was by Mr. Tom Lehrer, who is familiar to fans of the Dr. Demento Show all these many years. So Tom Lehrer, who, by the way, still alive, like 90 years of age and teaches like advanced astrophysics or some crap at Stanford.
Yeah, he's pretty amazing.
Like the smartest guy who's ever lived.
Yeah.
He's like your really square-ass uncle with the pocket protector who worked at, like, you know, NORAD. Or, you know, it like Rockwell or someplace, you know, but who also just was incredibly hilarious.
Yeah, who also just wrote these, like, insanely clever and twisted songs.
I remember the first time I heard Poisoning Pigeons in the Park.
I was just thinking of it. I almost mentioned that one specifically.
God damn, I love Tom Lehrer. It's going to be a sad day when he dies. You know, here's the thing. I don't mean to be all morose because we're getting, you know, it's the holiday season and, you know, the spirit of Christmas and Jesus and so forth.
Apparently, mice do have bones in their tails.
Really? Is that like a skeleton of a mouse?
Apparently, that's a skeleton of a mouse. Somebody, of course, a listener just emailed me a picture of a mouse skeleton so we can see that it has tiny little bones in its tiny little tail.
So during Legion of News, we were having a discussion about this mouse that in Japan, I swear to Christ, they've taught to tweet like a bird. Although taught is sort of it seems like it's a self-taught thing at this point.
No, it just it took them by surprise.
Achieving a sort of self-awareness, squawking for its compatriots to let it out of its cage so that it can wreak havoc on Earth. And then that begat this entire conversation about whether mice have bones in their tails because dogs have bones in their tails, which I didn't know.
They have a mouse that has a tail like a dachshund. So we were trying to figure that out.
And my whole thing is that I just assume that everything I don't understand is made of cartilage.
Oh.
And I'm not even really sure what cartilage is. I mean, I kind of know what it is. I mean, you know, I know what it looks like and, you know, sort of what its properties are. But I don't really know what it's made of. I mean, it's made of food like everything else. So, but I have no idea, like, what sort of substance it's made of. But I assume that cartilage is like, that is the miracle substance of all nature. It is the phlebotinum that holds everything together.
And I kind of assumed that mouse tails and rat tails, and I should know better because I've actually seen mouse skeletons.
Of course you have.
Well, there's this store in Berkeley called the Bone Store.
Petting it and asking who's a pretty girl for mama.
There's this place in Berkeley called the Bone Store, the Bone Shop, something like that.
Tell me more about the Bone Store.
And they have like awesome like skeletons and reproductions of skeletons of different animals and skulls. And they have all kinds of really cool like preserved and mounted insects. It's where I got my giant African stick insect that I have in a shadow box at home.
Awesome.
And they have things like you can get a little mounted on a little base. You can get on different bases skeletons that have been put back together of different animals. And they actually sell a mouse skeleton that has been reconstructed and mounted, sort of like a giant dinosaur at a museum, except as a mouse. And yeah, the bones in its tail and everything are super, super tiny.
I think it'd be great if they they mounted it sort of like, not a diorama, but you know what I'm talking, like an action pose or whatever.
Yeah.
And then
like
just
battling something.
Yeah, and just modified it ever so slightly, you know, like with just like tiny little horns, you know. And that's it. That would be the only modification.
There was this restaurant that I loved going to when I was a kid called Poor Richard's in Los Angeles. And the main reason I loved going there, it was the standard, like, sort of steak and cocktail place that my mom and grandma liked to go. But in the waiting area, the hallway, I don't know why, but this place had these little display cases set into the walls, like the glass display case, with little dioramas in them of mice. And they were, I'm assuming, actual stuffed mice. But they were wearing little clothes, and they had little. They were doing little things. There would be like a Wild West one, and then there was one that was like a Victorian parlor, and one little mouse was reading the newspaper and smoking a pipe, and the other one was cooking something on the stove. And it was like there were like six or seven of them along the walls. And as a child, I was fascinated by these. I just thought they were the most interesting things ever. And now as an adult, I think, why were they in a restaurant?
Seriously,
what were those doing there? And
the
who
hell?
Made that?
Well, it's like that place. Well, you know, Cheryl has mentioned, I don't know if we talked about it in the year, but Cheryl has mentioned there's a business, I won't even say, I probably shouldn't say where, but there's a business not too far from, a stone's throw from our studios, that it's like, you know, the Pendergrass Tool and Die Company, basically. It's just one of those, like, one of those sort of generic industrial product companies, like Amalgamated Hosing or something. But if you look inside, it's filled with dead mounted animals. And I mean, it's not like it used to be the Amalgamated, you know, hose company, and now it's, you know, and now it's like an animal place. It still obviously is like a tool factory or two, you know, like they sell like industrial parts. But if you look inside, there's just dead animals mounted all over the walls. You can see them from the street. She and I were outside last night. We're just looking in there going like, what in the name of Christ? And there's just no explanation.
Wow.
Well, that's like, I've showed you the antlers that are just sitting over here next to the building, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
On the so here at the studio, there's a sort of like a storage lot not too far from us. And in the storage lot are a bunch of those sort of like pod things. They look like railroad cars that people use, you know, for storage. And you can only see this from our roof. If you're up on the rooftop patio here at the plushly appointed ENN Studios, if you look down from the roof here, yeah, you can just see all these antlers bleaching away in the sun, which have just been there. And I don't know if that's related to the other business down the street that has all the animals mounted, or if we're in like some weird, you know, like Gunnar Hansen sort of, you know, fever dream of a neighborhood where it's just like everybody here, you know, where it's like a Farmer Vincent's Fritters kind of a thing. We've just wandered into this strange little town and don't really know the way that they operate around these parts.
I know one of our very first listener visits to the studio, the guy reaches in his pocket, Steve, and he goes, oh, here, Don, I brought you this gopher skull.
Yeah.
I'm like, well, thank you.
Yeah.
Which I do think is awesome, but at the same time, it's like, you know.
Oh, that was our good friend Scott.
Oh, Scott.
Yeah, Scott Landerville.
Scott.
Yeah. No, he reached in. He's like, I brought you a mole. And to be fair, he wasn't that creepy about it.
No.
He's a totally non-creepy, totally normal guy.
He's like, hey, I thought you'd like this, and I think he's going to give me like a piece of candy
or
something.
It really is that it's that we're the creepy ones, clearly, and that we just bring out. It's like we just magnify. You know what we are? We're like a sort of luminol of the soul. That you shine us, you know, you shine us on people, and then suddenly you just see all of the taint that they've been trying to hide these many years, and we just bring it out.
Well, the thing is, we are super, super creepy, but we're also lovable.
That's right.
So I think we make it okay for other people to embrace their own creepiness.
We're like an especially jocular Charles Adams cartoon.
Yes.
All right.
We're like, I got nothing.
Like a thing.
We're like Manson crossed with a Wookiee.
That's right. Sure. Speaking of which, somebody asked me if I'm going to be playing the R2-D2 Christmas song this year. I may or may not. Here's the thing is it's like Thursday.
Yeah.
And I mean, I guess technically I could be playing Christmas music on Monday, but you can't really do that. You got to kind of move on by then. There really is no interstitials. Here's the problem that I find is that there's no series of songs that really sound appropriate between Christmas and New Year's. Because I love the big ramp up where you're just playing Christmas music all the way up. Maybe even through like Christmas weekend, like Saturday and Sunday. But then Monday, it feels like you got to kind of shift gears. Like you can't be playing like Santa Claus is coming to town. But it seems like you got to be playing something of a holiday nature. And there really aren't a lot of like wrapping up the year songs.
Well, here's a little bonus for listeners if they're interested. Robert Wagner over at Cascadia FM. They're not going to be broadcasting on Saturday, on Christmas Day. But in the spirit of people, you know, just tuning in and listening to Christmas music, he's asked me to program several hours of Christmas music that will be played on a loop. It's going to be about 3 hours worth of music, and it's going to be played on a loop all day on Cascadia. So I could always slip that R2-D2 song into my thing. And if you want to hear it, you can tune in. You can listen on Saturday.
Or you could just be listening later this hour.
Oh, you're going to play it today, too?
It's kind of what I was leading up to.
Oh, it sounded like you weren't going to.
No, I was just lamenting the fact that we've got today and tomorrow, and I've got all of the stuff I haven't played yet. Because I just now got to Tom Lehrer. I got the R2-D2 We Wish You a Merry Christmas. I got to try to get to that. I have not one, not two. I mean, it's two, but in three parts. I have several different Stan Freeberg recordings that I have to.
Oh, please, yes.
And I'm going to do probably one of those today. I might do a Christmas Dragnet today, and we'll do Green Christmas, which is one of my favorite Stan Freeberg productions, tomorrow.
Oh, yes, please.
So we got all that coming up. But I'll give you a copy of that as well, because I know that his people, Robert Wagner's people, the people of the geek, they will probably enjoy hearing that. So I'll roll that out probably today, and then I'll give you a copy of that. We'll get to, let's see, we've got somebody calling in here, so we'll go to the phones in just a second. God damn, we're behind. We haven't even done anything. Joy of Christmas coming up today. Religious Nutcase Watch coming up today. Anna Griffin from The Oregonian is going to be in the studio with us. We'll do a top five. Now, we're going to do a top five. It's a little different today. We're going to actually do two back-to-back top fives, but they're not going to be musical as such. I'll just get some sort of, you know, regular music bed to go underneath them. But so, Dawn Taylor and myself will each be doing, we're each going to assemble and then count down a list of, I think, just the five must-have toys or items from our childhood. However we determine that. I mean, and that's sort of an amorphous thing in terms of like when it starts and when it ends.
Yeah.
But
I mean,
we all kind of have, you know, like a sense of when we were sort of lusting after toys as children. So it'd be the five items or toys you most wanted when you were a child. And this is, I'm not going to try to speak for everybody. This is not going to be like I'm, you know, speaking for all my generation. This will just be my assessment for me, I'm saying. The five toys or items that I most wanted as a child, and then you'll do the same. Let's do those later on, and we'll get to some thoughts from Anna Griffin on that as well. So that's coming up. Let's see. Don't forget, tomorrow, Christmas Eve, we're going to be doing several things. Our encore of Behind the Christmas, our encore of Ebenezer, I Barely Knew Her, which is our live radio play from a couple years back, and Tim Riley's Frank Sinatra Christmas. Those are all going to play tomorrow. Don Taylor today is working on the following headlines for your edification.
Retailers are staying open around the clock through Christmas. North Korea says they're willing to wage a holy war. And apparently North Carolina, the smell of death is everywhere.
Really?
Yeah.
What has that taken the place of?
Well, just parts of North Carolina, I guess. The smell of death is everywhere.
Okay.
That's a direct quote from the story.
All right, then. It's the Rick Emerson Radio Program. It's 503-505-6964. 503-505-6964. Let's... don't take us the wrong way. Oh, God. All right, let's go to the phone. See, this is, our good friend, and he's now become the official. He's now just become like a superhero, and his power. He's the corrector. Our good
is it
friend.
Thomas Gill?
No, it's.
Oh.
Wow.
He's the one who always corrects me on everything.
Jesus. That was sudden. I didn't really expect that to come out. I'm not really sure that you expected that to come out just now. I think that might have been a thing that was in your head. And then, like a soda that was improperly capped by Patrick at home, it just found its way out of the container and was suddenly live.
Well, you know, it's that thing. It's like I would, when I was manning the text boxes, he would pop up in the text box, and I'd be like, oh God, what did I say wrong this time?
Oh God, is it Thomas Gill? No, it is our good friend Andy. You were not here, Don. This is when Walker was filling in for you, and Andy was trying to help us to how Twitter operates, and he grew so exasperated that he finally, at the end, I said, "I'm just a baker," and then he basically hung up, which is a thing that has now been repeated back to me like hundreds of times by people. So, hello, Andy, how are you today?
I'm fantastic.
Okay. How can I assist you on this 23rd of December?
Well, first off, I feel like I'm more of a super villain than a superhero, just for the record. But
you're too cheerful to be a villain.
Well, it ties into why I'm calling.
Uh-huh.
Originally, I called to correct Don about the mouse tail bones thing.
Mouse tail bones thing. Oh, about... So this is... You called... Just for everybody, so this is like during Legion of News, we had this whole... We should read the story again later on, just because if people didn't hear Legion of News, I think it's a story that they would appreciate. But there's this horrific, scary, fascinating science story that came out of Japan, and it led to a discussion about whether or not mice have bones in their tails and dogs having bones in their tails, which I didn't know. So what was the nature... If you had stuck with your original plan, what's the nature of the correction? Just act it out for me now.
It would basically have been that both dogs... Dogs and mice have bones. You guys are utterly ridiculous.
Okay, all right.
Well,
but then you started talking about evil laughter, And I remembered something I recorded a while back and was wondering if I could play this real quick and see if it's good. It's like 5 seconds long.
Hold on a second. Let's just, what is, please to give us just a tiny thumbnail description of what you're going to play here.
A recording of me laughing evilly from a few months ago. Or maniacally. Maniacally is a better descriptor here.
Is this something you... Is this something you recorded to put on YouTube, or is this, like, were you just sitting around in your underpants?
It's something I recorded because a friend of mine who lives in England wanted to hear it.
So you had a friend, is this friend's middle name At?
No.
Okay, it's a real friend?
Yes.
Okay. And this friend, is this a male or a female?
Female.
So a female wanted a recording of you laughing maniacally.
It should be mentioned that I know a lot of theater people, and I kind of am one myself.
You know a lot of what?
Theater people.
That's hard to believe. Let me ask you this: is it when the female friend wanted to hear you laugh maniacally? What was the situation? What context led up to that request? I'm not disputing it. I'm just curious as to how you arrived at that.
I was pondering being Dr. Horrible or Jafar for Halloween.
Okay, see, there you go. Okay, I'm glad I asked because now I know. All right, so you're going to play us now a recording of you doing maniacal laughter.
Yes, and I'm not certain if you'll be able to hear it, but I'm going to give it a shot.
That's fantastic. Okay.
All right, here goes.
All right.
I apologize in advance here.
I'm sorry, I couldn't hear you. Somebody was crank starting a Model T in the foreground there. I wasn't able to. And there was a chicken coop driving by at the same time. Dawn?
It was like he was strangling a weasel.
It sounded strangely metallic. Let me ask you this: I don't even know why I'm asking this question. Is there a reason that you went to the trouble of actually calling us and then finding a recording of you laughing when you are, in fact, on the phone with us now?
Because I can't always match that recording live. Like, that's one of the best recordings I have, and I can't always match that recording on command. I can give you a shot if you want.
It's one of the best recordings you have. Approximately how many recordings of yourself doing a maniacal laugh would you say exist?
Not very many, because if they're shit, if they're crap, sorry, then I delete them.
What's going on over there, Andy? Are you wrestling with the microphone? Are you being attacked by something?
No, my computer is being attacked by my dog.
Okay.
This call is not going well.
No.
I want to hear the laugh.
Yeah, all right, Dawn. And really, I would say the call is actually going relatively well in the sense that we're amused. Dawn?
Yeah, I'm highly amused.
All right, okay.
Plus, I'm hoping that the maniacal laugh will drive his dog even further into a frenzy.
All right, you're gonna do the laugh for us here.
All right.
All right, hold on. Let me back to... Jesus.
Wow.
I wasn't really prepared for that. That was unnerving.
That was indeed maniacal.
Don't do that again. That was, or just give me more, like a 3-2-1 or something beforehand. Jesus.
Wow.
I would be careful around whom you did that, because it seems like that might get you looked at through a window in a small room for a long time.
That is more of a Joker laugh that is less appropriate to Jafar or Dr. Horrible.
I would say you're in full on Mark Hamill territory with that, with your Joker laugh there.
I do have a good Dr. Horrible laugh. It's just the less impressive of the two.
Yeah, I would say that you've peaked. I mean, no offense. I'm just saying, I think that's, in other words, that's the laugh you should be focusing on. If you're really going to refine a laugh, there's probably somebody right now who's filming like some sort of a Batman YouTube fan film, and he needs somebody to do a Joker laugh. You could be that somebody.
Oh, no.
Okay.
That's actually kind of both terrifying, and I kind of want to do that now. Okay.
Yes. All right. On that note, my friend, we should probably run here. We got to get to Anna Griffin. Big plans for your holiday weekend, sir?
Not the weekend per se. I'm going up to visit family in Washington just after Christmas.
All right. Well, travel safe and have a happy holiday. We will talk to you soon, my friend.
Thank you. You as well.
All right. Thank you. There you go. That was freaky. That's what that was. Jesus. You know, Mark Hamill, I got to say this, as much as I love Heath Ledger, in many ways, you know, Mark Hamill was... I feel bad for Mark Hamill because he was the definitive Joker for a long time, and in some ways still is, depending on your interpretation of the Joker. Not like I'm a huge Batman fan, but I mean, but he really just, he really went above and beyond. That he really redefined that whole character.
Yeah, he really did. It's really interesting because Patrick was the one who turned me on to all of that Batman animated series stuff, which was so good. It was just so well written, and the art direction of everything was so awesome. It's always, I always forget that Tim Daly was in that. He was like Superman or something like that.
Is that true?
Yeah. The actual people that played like Dana Delaney was doing like Lois Lane on the Superman version of that stuff. The list of actors that lent their voices, because speaking of Dr. Horrible, Neil Patrick Harris did something on there. That just in that whole universe of stuff they were doing, there were a lot of really amazing actors that did voice work.
That's one of those things I'm going to have to go back and watch again. I've got that entire series at home, and it's been a while since I've watched it. I just remember seeing it when I stumbled onto it late at night or something, whenever it was first on, and just... And I met at one point, I met somebody whose brother was an animator on that show. And he said something that I didn't realize, and I guess maybe this is a little bit of a trivia that, that like was that all fanboys knew way before I did, that they animated that show on black paper, not white. That the background, in other words, they started with a black background, as opposed to most animation, which is done on a white background. They started with a black background, so the default shade was always dark.
I didn't know that, but I guess that makes sense.
Yeah. Which is sort of awesome, I guess, and just very sort of Batman. Anyway.
By the way, to go along with the x-ray of the mouse tail, another listener sent in an x-ray of his dachshund. So that we could see what the dachshund's tail looks like.
Well, that's just weird.
So now you can see how the spine like goes down and it turns
that's
into
a tail. That's really strange. So does that mean their spine goes all the way into their tail?
Yeah. Yeah.
I guess your spine...
That's what a tail is. It's an extension of the spine.
I don't know. I was gone on that day.
That's why when, they experience emotions and stuff, the tail starts to move.
Dogs, we don't want to get talking about dogs again because they're just such a mystery to me. And I have all of these, well, in any event. real quick, let me read a couple of things, then we'll go to the news. We got Anna Griffin coming in later on. We'll do the top fives for today. Religious Nutcase Watch, Joy of Christmas. Way to go, this guy says, on the Tom Lehrer opening, poisoning pigeons in the park is my dad's ringtone on my cell phone. Excellent. Well done, sir. Let's see, a couple of things. One. I have a question for you.
Okay.
This is an outdated question. It's from 2 or 3 days ago, but I have it written down. I want to figure it out before the week is out. Okay. So you're a smart person. You know that whole eclipse thing that was happening on, Tuesday or Sunday or Wednesday or whenever it was? There was that whole thing with the lunar eclipse and the solstice and whatever. And they were like, it happens at 6:32 a.m. Greenwich Mean Time. Where is Greenwich? Why? Because, my iPhone has, and yours too, presumably, has a thing where you can get a clock for every, a time for any city in the world. You just type in, Madrid, and then it'll show you, in a New York Times newsroom, a separate clock for that. So I typed in Greenwich, and obviously it's not like Greenwich, Connecticut, and it's not like Greenwich, England, and it's not Greenwich Village. What is Greenwich?
I always thought it was like the North Pole or something like that. It's apparently there's an observatory in London.
The North Pole?
I think I always thought because...
I don't think there is time at the North Pole because at the top of the world, I don't think anything happens there.
Well, here's the thing. As a child, I would hear Greenwich Mean Time and I knew that there had to be a place that it was, at. And so I think I associated with Greenland.
Right.
So I thought it must be up at the North Pole or something somewhere. But apparently, no. There's an observatory in London.
Also, it is in London.
Yeah. It's the Royal Observatory. And that's in Greenwich, London.
Okay.
And that's basically where solar time at that observatory is Greenwich Mean Time.
Okay. We've got like 1,000 people now are yelling at me about it. I didn't know. So, for whatever reason, that was not recognized as a city. I guess maybe because it's not a city. It's the Greenwich Observatory in London or something. So had I known. Because then it's like you're just. And why do they bother to put things in Greenwich? Like we have $1 trillion technology. Why is it that when I'm reading Yahoo News, they put something in Greenwich Mean Time? And I'm a fairly sharp guy in some regard. And I couldn't figure out what the hell time it was actually happening. Yeah. Why can't they just say if you're on the West Coast, it's happening at 10 or something.
Well, I think because if you're sending out a story that has sort of global implications or something, it would take up a lot of space in your story to list what the different times are in all of the different places.
Doesn't it seem like here's the thing.
They're cutting you some slack and they're assuming you're smart enough to figure out the difference between where you are and Greenwich Mean
Time. Oh, they know that's not true. Here's the thing. If you log onto a website, depending on what browser you're using, it adjusts accordingly. Why can't it just use your IP address and figure out where you are and just change, Like, if you log on to certain sites in Spain, you'll get the Spanish version of the website. Why can't it just change, like, the one little word in the sentence, you know, in the story? You know, like, if you're a journalist, in other words, couldn't, if you were writing that story at Yahoo, couldn't you tag it the way you tag, like, a MySpace or, you know, Facebook photo or MySpace photo? You tag that as an item that is time zone sensitive. And then depending on the IP address, it displays the time for that region. Like, that's not a thing you could do or I could do, but that's a thing that, like, some Thomas Gill guy could do in, like, 10 seconds probably.
Yeah, I mean, I think that that's the sort of thing that we're probably going to see, like, in the future.
I should patent that right now.
But, you know, again, that means that whatever, like, the writer and or the whoever the web person is who's loading the stories up onto the website would have to know how to write the code to do that and would have to actually be aware that they needed to do it in that particular
See,
story.
Here's why I don't think that's true. Because if I get an email on my my iPhone, if somebody sends me a thing, and like sometimes, like, have you noticed this on your iPhone? If you get an email, it's one thing if somebody says, like, so anyway, we'll do that at 2 p.m. tomorrow. My iPhone turns 2 p.m. into a link, and I can click it, and it'll open that in my iCal so I can make a calendar date. It's not even just times, though. It'll do it with times in my email where I can press a time and it'll open my calendar to that time that day. If somebody actually sends me an email, though, and it says, so why don't we meet for lunch tomorrow? It actually highlights tomorrow and makes it a link. And if I press it, it opens that day in my calendar. So it seems like that technology already exists. I will demand, however, that everything be done in Zulu time. Zulu time. Which is like Tulsa time, but more interesting. More spears. You are listening to the Rick Emerson radio program. Thank you for joining us. So that's item the first. Item the second, which is the television show Mr. Smith. I'll get to here in just a few. You didn't know what that was. I'll explain it. I'm just going to say this. I was going to send this as a Twitter update last night. Do you ever avoid posting on Twitter or Facebook because it's late at night and you're afraid? And you're afraid that the timestamp will indicate something bad about you, like you never sleep or you're like loafing when you should be working?
Late at night?
No. Yeah.
No, not really. Mostly late at night, I think about the fact, depending on how late it is, I think, well, you know, if I post this to Twitter, no one's going to see it because everyone's asleep.
Yeah, but I suppose that's true. I was going to post this on the Twitter at like 2:45 or 3 o'clock last night, and I figured I would just get it like a deluge of like, you should be working, you should be sleeping, you should be, you know, whatever. But I was going to post the following statement that I have failed both as a man and as an American and as a citizen of planet Earth because my wife does not know what Emmett Otter's Jug Band Christmas is. She has never seen...
What the hell? Really?
I know. Welcome to my personal hell.
It's, and she grew up in, like, Utah.
Well, that's what she blamed it on. She's like, well, is it Jesus-affirming? And I was like, they're Otter. No, it's a jug... What do you mean, is it Jesus-affirming? And so her whole thing is that maybe she didn't see it because it wasn't, like, a Christy sort of thing. But it's like there were only three channels when we were kids anyway.
Yeah.
You couldn't avoid it. So, yeah, so... And the reason
oh,
I'm...
Wow.
And so, anyway...
Well, she's in for a treat then,
yeah.
Isn't she?
And so, so it's like, so I was mentioning Emmett Otter's Jug Band Christmas, and she's like, what's that? And I said, what do you mean, what's that? And she said, you know, what is it? Is that like a song or something? And I said, well, it was that thing where I had my conversation ground to a halt because I couldn't get over the whole, what is Emmett Otter's Jug Band Christmas? So she's never seen it. So, so tomorrow, Christmas Eve at our house, we've already started gathering the food, including, by the way, pub cheese, several varieties. Tonight and tomorrow, I'm going to be getting a fine selection of snack crackers and also meats. And then we're just going to sit around the house all day on Christmas, and we're going to do nothing but sit on the sofa, eat, watch television, play video games, and then occasionally nap, and then more eating.
That's pretty much my plan, too. As I mentioned in the last hour that when I dropped Patrick off for work today, he said, so if you were going to get a Christmas present, what would you want? Because, like, with him in the hospital and all that sort of thing, I assumed we just weren't bothering.
Right.
So I was like, oh, no. And I told him, I said, all I really want to do is just get some, like, food, like, tasty food, like crackers and cheese and sausages, and just sit around and watch movies all day. That's all I want to do. That's what I want for Christmas.
That's the best. See, and that, I can tell you, that's what we did last year. Only because last year she worked, I think, Christmas Eve and the day after Christmas. And I forget what I was doing, being sad and unemployed. And so we didn't go anywhere. And so we did it almost as like a fallback position. Like, well, we'll just get a lot of food and sit around the house and play video games and watch TV. And then it has now become, and it's like all capitalized, it's now become like the best Christmas ever is how we refer to it. And so now that is our goal every year is to recreate last year's Christmas because it was freaking awesome. By the way, I'd like to thank whoever it is that just on Twitter... Just posted my "Where is Greenwich?" Question with the hashtag ignorant radio host. Thanks so much. I appreciate that. You're awesome. Don't ever change. All right, at the news desk, it's Dawn Taylor.
And now, from the news desk, this is Dawn Taylor.
North Korea is ready and willing to wage a holy war against its southern neighbor if South Korea doesn't stop conducting military drills near their border. Minister Kim Yong-chun warned during a meeting in Pyongyang this week that the Revolutionary Armed Forces of the DPRK are getting fully prepared to launch a sacred war of justice of Korean style based on the nuclear deterrent at any time necessary.
Here's the thing. You got to give it up to those guys. They're great at the nomenclature. You know, a sacred war of justice.
Of Korean style,
which is sort of like drunken style, but not entirely.
While the drills have technically been taking place in sovereign territory, they've ramped up tensions between the countries and undermined the movement toward peace talks. After North Korea shelled the South's Yongpyeong Island in an attack last month, South Korean President Lee Myung-bak replaced his top military brass with more hawkish officials. Today's threat comes hours after South Korea launched one of the largest live-fire exercises ever, deploying helicopters, tanks, and planes as a show of force against North Korean aggression.
So let me understand this. If they don't stop pretending to have war, then they will have an actual war. They'll be punished by having an actual war for having the fake one.
That's pretty much it.
Okay.
I think it's like when you're in the back seat with your brother and he keeps like poking you and poking you and poking you and poking you, and then you finally just punch him in the head.
You've had it. I have had enough of this.
BBC and Al Jazeera say that the statement is probably empty rhetoric, but even so, this is the first time the North has actually threatened to retaliate over the drills.
I mean, and here's the thing is, like, they seem to be largely crazy. They're the folks who run that country. So, I mean...
Well, both of them, really.
Yeah, I don't really know that it's empty rhetoric. You know, anytime a guy just spends all of his days drinking whiskey and watching porn and has a lot of nuclear weapons, which apparently are all true, by the way, that's a guy that you probably, you know, there's no such thing as empty rhetoric. It's just sort of it's like a grab bag. It's like a Monty Hall kind of rhetoric, you know? What's in the box? Is it a real threat or is it a fake threat?
And he has sharks and like a room full of giant cats.
What do you mean I don't understand.
Oh, wait, I'm thinking.
I mean, I know what
I
all those words.
Team America.
Okay. I was just going to say, I know what all those words mean.
Wait, that didn't actually happen.
Can I just tell you that Team America references, sadly, are sort of lost on me? And I realize that this is a gap in my pop culture knowledge. That Team America references, I get some of them. I get the I'm Ronery and Everybody Has AIDS and the endless River of Vomit. I get all that stuff. But having only seen that movie once and not liking it all that much. It's just one of those things that with passing years, the more obscure Team America references are going to go right over my head.
Yeah, it's certainly not my favorite of the Trey Parker and Matt Stone oeuvre, but there are a few things in it that just I found completely hilarious. And one thing was the Panthers, which were just black house cats that were set loose on puppets.
I just remember being so weirded out that Phil Hendry was the voice of the computer.
Yeah.
That was it just kept weirding me out. I couldn't get past it.
I didn't know that that was going to be the case, actually. And I remember sitting in the theater watching the movie, and you have that moment when your brain just kind of goes, your brain kind of taps itself against your skull and goes, I'm done.
Wait a minute.
And you're going, wait a minute.
My God, it's Phil Hendry. That and the Matt Damon thing never got old. The entire film, they could have made an entire movie of just the Matt Damon thing, and it would have just, that I would have paid to see that.
And that, of course, has led to like thousands of it, my husband and I include, that whenever you hear any reference to Matt Damon, you just immediately respond going, Matt Damon!
Hey, by the way,
And then laugh.
Can I just tell you, and it's got to be, here's the thing about that is, it's got to be weird to be him, because you know he must get that like every day of his life walking down the street. And I mean, there are worse problems to have. Matt Damon's got a pretty good life. But you know that that guy can't go to get a taco without just, you know, Matt Damon! You know, and he's just, yeah, it's great. Thanks. Thanks so much. I mean, it's better than being Jimmy Walker, I suppose.
And he will always be associated with what's his name? God, why did I suddenly forget his name?
I don't know. Here's the thing. You're saying,
wow,
what's his name? And if you're saying who I think you're going to say, it leads into exactly what I was going to say next. So
I'll go ahead and say your thing.
No, I'll give you a moment to.
How you have that thing when it's like something is right on the tip of your tongue, it's about to come out of your mouth, and your brain just shuts down.
Just take a second.
Affleck.
There you go. Ben Affleck.
Ben Affleck.
Well done. You know what I was just going to say? I was going to take as long as that. If you would have required an hour to do that, I was going to give you an hour.
I think my dislike of Ben Affleck, despite the fact that I really liked the last two movies that he directed, and I've even liked him in a couple of movies recently, it's just that I had such a loathing of Ben Affleck for so long that my brain just doesn't even want to go there.
It won't even conjure it up anymore. It's like you can't even say his name.
Yeah.
I was actually just going to say, speaking of that I saw The Town. That's a great movie.
It really,
it really,
really
is. It's not perfect, but it's a really, really good movie.
Well, did you see Gone Baby Gone?
I did. I love that.
Yeah. See, he's a surprisingly good director.
Yeah.
With a really, really good grasp of scripts.
Yeah, and Gone Baby Gone was good, but, you know, it's like thinking, well, maybe it's a fluke or maybe it's just the source material. You know, and again, I don't dislike Ben Affleck. I have rooted for that guy, like, since day one, even as he made, like, an increasingly poor series of choices.
Oh, I just always thought he was just horribly untalented and just really, really disliked him. And then he made, the movie where he played Reeve.
Oh, Hollywoodland.
Yeah, Hollywoodland. And I was like, oh my God, he's good.
Here's the thing about...
And in The Town, he not only directs it, but he's really good.
He's great in it. And here's the thing about Ben Affleck, in my opinion, that Hollywood, the producers did not learn and that I could have told them. Ben Affleck is, to me, a little bit like Adam Sandler. Now, again, the box office results say that it's not true with Adam Sandler, but I believe it to be true regardless. That not unlike Adam Sandler, I think Ben Affleck is a good actor. I think he's a talented actor. And I think he's sometimes underused and often underrated actor. He's not a leading man, though. That's the thing. He's not traditionally – he is not a leading man type. And that has nothing to do with talent or looks or whatever. It's just some guys are leading men. Some guys are the leading man's best friend. Some guys are the sidekick to the leading man. Some guys are like – you know, so some guys are the boyhood chum of the leading man. Adam Sandler seems that way to me. He is sort of sidekick guy. Affleck is the same way. But they kept trying to make him into Tony Curtis or something.
Because he's tall and he's conventionally handsome.
Yeah.
So he must be a leading man.
But Gone Baby Gone, I remember that was just astonishingly good. And I thought, okay, well, I'll reserve judgment. But this is really, really good. Maybe he's got something. And then I saw The Town, which reminded me a lot of Heat in many ways.
Yeah.
It was sort of a classic kind of heist film, but with a lot of gritty sort of, you know, had just a great look to it and a great sense.
There really is kind of, now that you mention that, there is kind of a Michael Mann quality to his directing as well.
And I love, and here's the thing that I never get tired of if it's done well. I never get tired of Guy and all of his friends from the neighborhood who grew up together. That is, and I don't know if that's a guy thing or not. I suppose there's some female equivalent to that, but it's like, you know, it's like that sort of like the Sleepers kind of a thing, where it's like the guys from the hard scrabble, you know, end of town who all kind of grew up in the same neighborhood with Father Jimmy. You know, it's like I am a sucker for those movies. And Affleck really, I mean, he really makes it work. And also, what's his name? John Hamm is on screen and actually does not come across like Don Draper. I managed to forget that he's Don Draper when I'm watching him.
John Hamm was actually, I thought, a little miscast. And he actually comes off a little bit stiff.
Yeah.
Who was the other agent with him? It wasn't Joel McHale.
I know who you're talking about because he's the guy that plays what's his name on Sons of Anarchy.
Yeah. And the two of them together were really
Jimmy O'Fallon or whatever his name is. Yeah.
Yeah, Titus Welliver.
Yes, exactly.
My imaginary boyfriend.
Now, is he Irish or is he American? Or what
I think
is
he's American.
Okay, so the accent on Sons of Anarchy is not real.
No.
Okay.
But the thing I liked about both Gone Baby Gone and The Town also is, and I like that Affleck seems to deliberately go in that sort of direction. I'm not fond of movies. I've realized this recently. I don't like movies that are a guy has to deal with forces that are beyond his control. A guy just stumbles into something.
Right.
And then all of a sudden he's running for his life and trying to convince people that he's not the killer
enemy
or something
of the
like
state.
That. There's so many movies that are like that. And I've realized I don't ever really like that. On the other hand, though, I love movies that are about a guy who ends up in a situation of his own making, and he has to decide where his loyalties lie.
Right, right.
And I think what it is the difference between, you know, a person who is dealing with a problem that is from outside himself versus a guy who's working on something that is within himself and within his own head and his own heart. And I think the second one is a lot harder to pull off because it involves actual, you know, writing.
And acting.
And character development and acting. Whereas the first one, you can just have, you know, Will Smith running around while
you
people are shooting
You must believe me.
At.
I'm not insane.
Yeah. And both Gone Baby Gone and The Town were both really good examples of that, of someone, you know, having to decide – you know, what direction
right.
he's going to take his life and who his loyalties are going to be to. And, you know, his love of, you know, the people he's always been with versus the love of the woman he's just met. You know, it's, you know, and I love those kinds of movies.
I
really do.
And I'm a huge fan. Here's another thing that I like a lot. And then we'll get this call and we'll take a break because Anna Griffin is sitting in the green room. And then I got to go to the thing about, hey, I'm running late this week. And then she says something snarky like, as opposed to every other week. And then I am filled with shame. I do love movies where a guy is either, and this can be really hackneyed, but sometimes, you know, it can be handled really well. And it's where a guy has, he's basically trying to tie up a bunch of loose ends and get out of town, you know, before it all goes to hell. And a movie that I don't care for, but that has that same premise. And it was one of the reasons that I found it so frustrating is Things to Do in Denver When You're Dead, which I really didn't like all that much. But I do love that kind of movie. And The Town has some of that, too, where it's like he's, you know, he's just trying to get everything taken care of and get his ducks in a row so he can, like, blow the whole joint and just be shut of the entire thing. And because then it's, you know, then it is like it has – and that can be like a real cheap device to create tension in the wrong hands. But again, in The Town. So anyway, the bottom line, if you haven't seen The Town, which is the new Ben Affleck film. And it's, by the way, and what a dick move the studio did. They're such jerks to him. When they did the ads for The Town, they wouldn't even use his name in it. They actually would just say, from the director of Gone Baby Gone, Ben Affleck. And it was just, it was like when they're trying to pitch you a Woody Allen film or something, or a Spike Lee joint, and they bury the name of Spike Lee or Woody Allen way at the end because they don't want to frighten off the audience. So yeah, he got really he got shafted a little bit there, but it's a great movie. Let's see, we should do this, and then we'll take a break. Hello, hi, you're on the Rick Emerson Radio Program. Why, hello.
Hello.
Hello, sir, madam, as the case may be. Okay, thanks for calling. I appreciate that. Call again.
Did you just sit there on hold that whole time just to hang up?
Sat there waiting for 90 seconds to get on the air, and then they can hang up. Thanks. I appreciate that. Time well spent, my friend. It is 503-505-6964. We should do this. We'll come back on the other side with Anna Griffin. We'll do the top fives here in a bit. We've also got your Joy of Christmas, Religious Nutcase Watch, and more. You're listening to the Rick Emerson Radio Program. Don't go anywhere.
You're listening to the Emerson News Network.
Arthur, where are you? Oh, there you are. Well, if you come over here, you'll find a wonderful surprise. You'll have to plug into the central computer to hear what it is. That's right. No, it's not a phase vector. It's your Christmas present.
Converter isn't complete yet. It isn't finished. Lock in your circuits again quickly. Christmas.
Rick Emerson Radio Program. Thank you for joining us today. It's 503-505-6964. 503-505-6964. All right, so I believe whoever that was that was calling on the other side of the break, I think they have called back. So we'll go to the phones here in just a second. Anna Griffin's going to join us in just a moment from the Oregonian. Later on, Don Taylor and I will be doing a sort of back-to-back top fives. The top five toys slash items most coveted by us when we were small fry. So we'll get to that. Let's see. Religious Nutcase Watch coming up. Joy of Christmas coming up. I got to do the Mr. Smith thing here in just a moment. Let's see. Before I do anything else, let's just see if I can. Hello, sir, madam, as the case may be. You're on the Rick Emerson show. How can I help you today?
Yeah, Rick. This is the mailman, Rick. How are you guys doing today?
I am doing dandily, sir. Did you? Was it you that attempted to call earlier on in the program?
No, that wasn't me.
All right. Okay. So congratulations on being able to use a phone properly. That has eluded at least one third of the callers today. How is your Thursday going, my friend?
Everything's going a little crazy, but that's because I'm a mailman, so this time of the year is my hell. So.
Are we doing any drinking today, Rick?
No, I don't drink.
Okay, just checking. So this is, are you on the job right now? Are you out delivering as we speak?
No, I'm not. I actually have a day this week they did not call me into.
Wow.
So when you, I was just going to say, Dawn echoes what I was going to say, which is I was sort of assumed that you guys just had, were on the clock like all the time, that it was just, that there was, you had like a 3-day just like baton death march of present delivery.
Well, I'm a rural carrier and I'm a sub, so that means I'm on call. So this year my regular is actually doing very well. He hasn't needed me as much as before, but still, it's been insane.
Now, let me ask you this.
Because,
so if you're delivering a lot of stuff, I mean, it's like there's only so much room in the truck, right? And there's only, you know, and you, like you're carrying the mail satchel or the whatever. So it seems like it's not even an issue of time. It seems like there's probably just not even like the physical capability to take out all the stuff on your route that needs to be delivered, right? I mean, there's got to be more stuff to deliver than there is space in which to store it.
Well, especially when you're running an 82 old postal Jeep like mine.
Yeah, so I mean, do you have to do like multiple trips back to the place to pick up your packages?
Usually not, because I'm on one of the larger rural routes and I don't have as much mail density and population density as some people, but I still get a lot of packages this time of year. But this year is crazy because it's also an election year, so we've been nonstop since like September.
Let me just, have you noticed, how long have you been at this gig? How long have you been delivering mail, sir?
I've been a post a rural carrier for 6 years now.
Have you noticed a decrease in the amount of junk mail delivered? You know, via, you know, just like via the regular post, like, you know, the, like just flyers and, you know, just stuff people obviously didn't ask to receive, just a bunch of like advertising crap. Have you noticed a decrease in that over the last few years?
It seems that there has been a decrease in a lot of letters and what we call flats, which are like magazines or flyers that are larger than your standard letter. But mostly what we've seen an increase in is in packages.
That's what I was going to ask, because I'm assuming because so many people just every year more and more people are shopping online for things that I imagine that every year you're seeing a constant increase in the amount of packages.
Yeah, Don. Yeah.
You ever just, let me ask you this. It's just you and I speaking here. At any point, have you ever just thought to yourself, like, I should just put half these letters down the storm drain? I mean, just if you know, you just like you wake up one day and you're just like you're going to like your 97th house and it's like you're tired and you're grumpy and it's sleet and hail and gloom of night and you just think to yourself, no one's going to miss these letters. I could just they could just go right into a shredder somewhere. Nobody's going to be the wiser.
Officially, no. Officially, yes. I wanted to do a Newman. Yes.
Good answer. Well done, sir. Awesome. Well, yes.
I like that the official term among mailmen is to do a Newman.
Well, that's because every industry probably has their televised or their fictional example, right? Of the of the colleague gone wrong. I mean, excellent. Well, thank you, my friend, for calling in. Have a safe and happy holiday, sir.
Well, we've met, guys. I don't know if you remember me from the Fun Employment.
I do. I do remember you.
Were you the one that was groping Dawn?
I was the guy with Marvin the Martian cap on.
I do remember you. Okay, now that's not just a thing. That's not just a thing I'm saying to feign some sort of a comradeship here. That I do actually remember you because Marvin the Martian. There was this tiny little window of time. There was this little slice of our existence about 12 years ago where Marvin the Martian I felt was getting his due, and then it's like immediately everybody just went back to goddamn Taz stuff everywhere, and I could do without that, frankly. So, all right. Well, from all of us to you and to everybody who delivers out there, we always, we've said for years that if we could just do a survey of just guys who deliver things or spend their day behind a steering wheel of some kind, we would have like 99% penetration. So, happy holidays from us to you, sir. Thank you for listening.
Yeah, and thank you for giving me something to listen to through all the insanity of my routes.
Well, it's what we do, sir. Improving your life in ways almost beyond imagining. Thank you. There you go. That is letter carrier Rick, who is out there. Awesome.
So I had to tell you, since you just said that, my husband, actually, Patrick, just received a get well / Christmas gift from his sister, who lives in Pennsylvania, and it was a pillow with Marvin the Martian on it.
See, here's Marvin the Martian really is, he's a character that just, I think only appeared maybe in two or three cartoons. I mean, it's really, I mean, in a very small number of those, but he had a cultural impact that is disproportionate. Not unlike that gossamer creature that is in the castle, yes, with the mad scientist. It's just hair and tennis shoes. Let's welcome now to the Rick Emerson radio program. She writes a twice-weekly column covering life in Portland and Multnomah County. Anna Griffin, hello. How are you today?
I am good. How are you, Rick?
I'm fantastic. We should say, by the way, that Anna brought us gold. So these are sort of a gold chocolate reindeer.
Lindt gold milk chocolate reindeer.
It's the Lindt and Sprungli company, yes. Isn't that? And there's an umlaut, which automatically makes it awesome. So thank you.
It's sophisticated. That's what the umlaut does.
How is what is life like in the newsroom right about this time of year? Because on the one hand, you got to figure that everybody's sort of, they're getting ready to sort of slack off and they kind of phoned in for the next few days or whatever. But then there's that thing where it's like there's all of that advertising that's got to run, and there's all of the stuff, and they want to bow, for every page of advertising, they got to have like a page of like news, and so you got to be cranking that stuff out too, right?
There's this thing where editors do where they try to encourage you to hold things to run Christmas weekend and explain to you that people really, they read the paper. It's big papers on the weekend. Nobody reads the paper Christmas weekend.
Is that true? Because I was always told, now see, this is a thing that maybe I just learned is completely wrong. When I was, I don't know, however old, and they was, I don't know if it was just in high school or if I was like at a radio station or something, but they would said, like, if you want to get your press release into the paper, said you do it on a holiday, because that's the day that they need the most. Although I guess that's
it will get in the paper.
That's not the same thing, I guess, as it. Saying it's actually going to be read. Okay, now saying it out loud, I see the flaw in my logic there. All right, sorry, fail. So do you have big plans in the Griffin household for your holiday?
We're going to open some gifts. We're going to go see a movie. We're going to go out for Chinese food. We're a mixed family. So my partner's Jewish, so we celebrate both Christmas and the Jewish Christmas.
And you just sort of smush them all together.
We do. Yeah.
The Jewish Christmas, of course, being Chinese food.
That would be the movie and the Chinese food, yeah. They're very upset that the Goys figured out that going to see a movie on Christmas Day is the thing to do. They're very resentful of that.
Well, because sometime within the last 8 or 9 years, Christmas Day became the single biggest movie-going day of the year, which I think is, by the way, an indication of how much people actually want to spend time with their family as opposed to how much they say they want to spend time with their family.
And again, please note, they're going to see movies. They're not actually reading the newspaper.
Yes. So. Mm.
What movie are you going to say?
I think we're going to go see Tangled. The kids have seen it already, but I hear it's good. So
it is. It is quite entertaining. You will not be bored.
I was very pleased with my daughter. My daughter came home. She had her hair cut off this summer, and it has not grown back. And I was very pleased to find out that Rapunzel has to lose her hair to become a true, powerful princess. I was a little concerned about there was going to be a lot of screaming and requests for a wig after that.
This is the new Disney? This is the Disney thing?
It's actually really quite good.
I think you were the one who told me that, actually, that you went to. You said that they was it yesterday we were talking about Disney and that whole weird period where they were making, like, the Black Cauldron and the Black Hole, I think. And they made Secret of Nim right around that same time, didn't they?
Was that Disney?
That's not.
I don't
Disney.
Know.
I don't think that was Disney.
Was that maybe the first movie that Don Bluth made after he left?
Yes.
So he left. So the Black Cauldron was the last. Was the last movie he made at Disney, and then he took a bunch of guys with him, I think, when he defected, and they made The Secret of Nim, which is not as good as the book, but which is a fine film. I mean, I take no issue with that.
Yeah.
Okay, all right. These are the sorts of things that really will keep me up at night. Like the name of the creature, you know, in the Warner Brothers cartoons, it's just hair and sneakers, which is Gossamer, which is a thing that in the pre-internet time that I agonized over, like, for weeks before it came to me, like, in a dream one night.
Monsters are such interesting people.
Here's the very, can I just tell you this about that? Here's one of the moments where you realize this is why Warner Brothers cartoons are infinitely superior to Disney cartoons, like in every conceivable way. And it is what Peter Jackson would call painting in the corners, you know, where it is the attention to details that other animators or other production houses would view as insignificant or unimportant, but that make all of the difference in sort of the transmogrification of Bugs Bunny from, again, just like paint on plastic to an actual real person in your mind. It's when he's sitting down there, and well done on the accent just there, by the way. So he's sitting down behind Gossamer, and he's parting Gossamer's hair in the middle to each side, and he takes out those, what are they, the bobby pins?
Yes.
And he does the thing of bending them in his teeth before he puts them into Gossamer's hair, which that must have taken them like 9 days to animate. I mean, if Bugs Bunny, and why would you have that? Why would it be necessary for an effeminate rabbit to be bending bobby pins in his teeth before? And it's because it completes the picture, right? It's the brushstroke on the personality painting that is required. So, well done. Let's go to the news desk here, and we'll find out what is happening in this big, bold, bright, fantastic world of ours.
And now, from the news desk, this is Dawn Taylor.
Let's do our religious nutcase watch.
Here is your religious nutcase watch for Thursday, December 23rd, 2010, right here on the Rick Emerson radio program. Dawn Taylor.
Michelle Phipps of Dublin, Ohio, thinks an image she found on a pistachio shell looks like Jesus.
Of course.
A coworker brought the nuts to the office to share with other employees. Phipps said one of the nuts stood out from the rest.
Yes, I guess it does, Ms. Phipps, doesn't it?
Her coworkers thought they saw some other images in the nut. Phillips said, "We all started joking about it and talking about it. One thought it looked like Jason from the movie, or Freddy Krueger, or George Washington. All sorts of things."
That really doesn't speak well for Jesus and his aesthetic features.
The face is getting lots of attention on her Facebook page. Regardless of who it actually resembles, Phipps says she plans to preserve it.
Did maybe one of the coworkers see the number for a crisis hotline written on the side of the nut? I demand, okay, here's, okay, this is what we should do. This is what should be one of our goals for 2011. This is like that whole, so there was this thing that happened on the show some years ago. Have I ever mentioned, Anna Griffin from the Oregonian, that someone named their child after me?
Wow, no.
Here's a thing that is a thing you should get used to hearing, because if we know each other for any
ignorant
period of time.
Radio host McGee.
Thank you. I will probably mention this to you 70 or 80,000 more times, during the course of our relationship. Her name is Emerson Ava, and it was because I was just lamenting on the air that because there had been a baby born, and it was strictly by coincidence, but they named the kid Dylan Riley. And at that point, Sarah Dillon and Tim Riley were the other people on the show. And I was, you know, and so I was throwing a big fit about it.
Your feelings were hurt.
And, you know, and even though it was just a coincidence, I was lamenting that, you know, where is the love for me? Rick Emerson, who gives so much and asks so little, except that you name your child after me. And is that too much of a payment? I don't think so. And in fact, it's not, because there was a set of parents who named their kid after me, Emerson Ava. And then this is equal parts sort of great and just sort of, I don't know, just weird, not even unsettling, just sort of strange that like about every year, 18 months, like I get updated. It's like I've adopted one of those kids like in Nairobi or something, where it's like I get pictures every now and again in the mail showing me how little Haji's doing. And it's like, but now it's little Emerson Ava taking her first step. Here's Emerson Ava with a sippy cup. And it's just sort of strange, you know, not that it's actually happening.
Are you sending her savings bonds every year or putting money away into her college account the way you should?
No, I think about it and then I do something else.
I'm going to name my next dog, by the way, Rick Pig Baby.
Thank you. I think that for 2011, we should make it our goal. We should have some listener should see like my image on something absurd. And then we should call like a press conference and we should demand that every bit of press in the city cover it as a crucial and important story. You know what I mean?
It can't be that hard to get like an image that looks vaguely like you on a grilled cheese sandwich.
Why don't people ever notice like Satan on things?
Well, no, that's not true. They do. So Satan was seen in that hurricane. There was some tropic storm year, 18 months ago, where they saw Satan's image. Also,
and every once in a while, there will be like mold or like soaky bits on people's walls.
But
and
it's
it
never
like
something
the devil.
Positive.
No, it's never something good.
No, there was an oil rig explosion in Texas a few years ago. One of those like red Adair things that happens, and it's like and they claim they saw the face of Satan in the billowing plumes of smoke coming.
Now, to be fair, all of these stories were reported by the Weekly World News, so they may not be entirely.
But
accurate.
I mean, yeah, I mean, what I want to know is people who are seeing Satan in, say, a Frito or Satan in.
Yeah, they don't see it on their Pop-Tart.
Right. I mean, if we're going to reduce Jesus to a pistachio nutshell, that's. Mm.
Do you suppose this is like a thing, Jesus is sort of the Dr. Brundle of the religious world. Like he's trying to make the second coming happening, but he just keeps screwing it up somehow, and he keeps crossing his genes with those of a potato chip, you know. And somewhere he's up in heaven, and Gina Davis is going like, "You're meddling with nature, Jesus," and he says, "Damn it, Gina, I just don't," you know. And then he gets back, and then he comes and he like comes out in a Cheeto or something.
Or he's in a tiny mouse, but instead of saying, "Hey, I'm Jesus," he's tweeting like a bird.
Well, I don't want to sound like a heretic or anything.
Blessed are the peacemakers.
Like that.
I'm sorry.
But I mean, what does it say about your faith if you're willing to believe that your Lord and Savior is going to appear to you on a pistachio nutshell?
Well, I mean, you see God in all things, I would imagine.
Well,
that's what they would tell
again,
you.
Again, though, it's telling that other people in the office saw like Freddy Krueger or George Washington. I mean,
don't you think that's just them giving her? Yeah.
The thing is,
yeah, Miss Phipps, I see.
That really is
I
a
see
great,
my mom.
It's a great cultural Rorschach, though, I think.
Well, there's a book I read, and again, this is a book about like sort of, you know, supernatural, not supernatural, but you know what I mean, X-file-y sort of things.
Right.
And I had read this book about the phenomenon of people seeing like gray aliens and the big blue aliens and that sort of thing. And what they posited, and I'm not saying I believe this, but I'm saying it's positive, is that throughout, you know, mankind, there have been sightings of small little guys and of tall sort of bluish people. And that if these beings actually existed, they're sort of out of the realm of our comprehension. So our brain maps something onto it. And if you're like living in Ireland, for example, and you see a little grayish green guy, you see a leprechaun. If you are living, you know, in the middle of Mexico somewhere, you see Mezcalito. You know, if you see like a tall blue, you know, sort of friendly female being, you know, you might see an alien or you might see the Virgin Mary if you live in a Catholic country.
So it's sort of like a visual version of the iPhone autocorrect.
Yeah.
Where you're trying to type like frappe and it says Führer.
Yeah, your brain is just going, crap, I don't know what this is.
Yeah.
It's a talking dog, you know, because nothing else makes sense to your brain.
It's just like doing that CIA thing of just going through the fingerprint file and it just hits the closest match.
So I think if you see some vague sort of Rorschach-y blobs that look kind of like maybe it could be a long-haired person with a beard, if you are predisposed towards Christianity, you think Jesus. If you're not, you might think, I don't know, Greg Allman.
There's
somebody
all kinds
should
of...
totally see Greg Allman. This, I mean, that seems like a sort of real life meme that we could launch like right now, you know? Greg Allman or, you know, like or Bruce Valanche or, you know, or like Sally Struthers. You know, where you just go like, Sally Struthers is in my ramen. It's amazing. So two things. One, I demand now, this is Rick Emerson said this, now I am pleased to be seeing my image on some sort of item, preferably a consumable of some sort in the first quarter of two. That's March 31st to you and me. That's by the end of first quarter 11, like that. It's just so we can conjure the. So if you see a press release come across your desk about that at some point, Anna, you'll know.
You'll know the gig.
You'll know what's going on here. But I'm just saying.
I'll bring a camera.
Play along.
That and also, I am now officially reserving the right to form a metal band at some point and call it Brundle Christ. So just so you're knowing, just FYI. There's your religious nutcase watch for Thursday, December 23rd, 2010. Rick Emerson radio program. Don't forget, tomorrow our Christmas Eve show will air. We will have our yearly presentation of Behind the Christmas, which is now, God damn, I'm old, which is nearly a decade old that we did that. And in fact, I think half, Jesus, probably 4/5 of the people who are on. And here's the thing about that, about Behind the Christmas, if you haven't heard it yet, I don't think it's downloaded. I don't think it's in the archives, but it's this. It is this idea that at the time was really, really great, and then became really dated, and now is sort of retro. And so it was a behind the music parody, but about the life of Santa, which basically just exists so I can do one of the two voices that I'm able to do, which is the other one being Hank Hill. I can do Hank Hill, and I can do the behind the music narrator. So there's that, and then we have our live radio play from a couple years ago, Ebenezer, I Barely Knew Her. We'll do an encore of that, and then Tim Riley's Frank Sinatra Christmas special will be airing as well. So that is coming up. Tomorrow.
You know, it's been so long now at this point that you could actually, we could go and revisit all of the people who took part in that, and you could do a behind the Christmas.
Here's the thing is I've actually thought about doing that, about doing following up, because I mean, I'm trying to think of the people who are in that, and I think most of them have moved or are no longer in Portland for one reason or another, or no longer on the radio. And I think a great number of them, I think a lot of them are no longer like in the industry at all. So I don't know. I think I'll have to make a list or something that I'll see actually who's – because I think Tim Riley is in it. Tim Riley is in it. Mike Chase, who now does, of course, it'll be Mornings at the Wolf, is on it. A woman named Suanna, who was at KWJJ at the time and who is now, I think, in Nashville. God damn, who else? I mean, it just seems like there's an endless list of people, but I think they've moved. Timmy Ryan's not in that, is he? No, he's not. All right, well, in any event, that'll be tomorrow, though. So we'll do Behind the Christmas, we'll do the Ebenezer, I Barely Knew Her, and Tim Riley's Frank Sinatra Christmas special. Anna Griffin from The Oregonian. So we are heading into, I guess, Christmas, which is going to be New Year's next year. And I don't know if you're going to be in the studio or not next week. I don't know what your schedule is. But this is where we would typically do our, what are the big stories for 2010? What are the stories that people did not pay, though, enough attention to that they probably should have? What did people not follow this year that should have gotten more attention?
There was the economy. Something didn't happen there.
Something about a recovery.
Something about
fiscal stability.
And environmental chaos in the Gulf of Mexico. And oh, we're still at war in Afghanistan.
Apparently.
I don't know if you knew that.
Are we still at war? I don't mean to sound daft. Are we still at war in Iraq? See, and I ask it, I don't even really know. I mean, it just sounds
we're
like
still
I'm
occupying it. I don't believe they're considering it a war.
Well, I mean,
at this point.
We didn't like officially declare it or anything, but I mean, are we over? I mean, is it still like we're pushing our way in and just shooting at everything we see, or not? I just don't know.
We were never at war in Iraq, Rick.
Thank you. Or in Oceania.
we're helping to bring them freedom.
All right. Yes. At a high velocity in tiny, tiny, tiny little projectile-shaped packages. But is there anything that leaps off the page to you as just not having gotten the attention that it deserved, you know, either in Portland or elsewhere?
Well, I mean, to get on a soapbox for a second, I mean, I think we do, those of us who are lucky enough to be here and don't have loved ones in the military, I think it's easy to forget that we are still engaged in serious combat in Afghanistan.
Well, has it been, was it before or after Iraq?
It was before Iraq. It was October 2001.
So that's actually Jesus. So we're going on like 10 years of being over there. Yeah. I mean, which I believe, and I don't know, but I think it's longer. I think you told me this was longer than the Soviets were there.
Yeah.
So I mean, which is just and
they're looking at us and going, "How's that working out for you, comrade?"
You know, and it just doesn't. I mean, it just seems like it's such a half measure, and not like I anything. You know, my military experience basically just consists of like losing at risk a lot. You know, when I was in eighth grade, so that's kind of it. But. It just seems like we're trying to thread this needle, this sort of middle ground needle of not, you know, like we didn't just stay out or just get out when it became clear that it wasn't going the way we thought it was going to go. And we also just are not willing to go in and just, you know, use overwhelming force to just settle it one way or the other. We're doing this strange sort of like in between half measure of force, which just has the effect of prolonging and elongating the entire thing.
Well. Yes. And we also, let's look back on it. None of us are historians, but we can come up with plenty of examples off the top of our head where we're trying to fight two wars at one time is a bad idea.
Yeah. Which is the thing that you always hear from the military, too, that's what sets the U.S. military apart, is that we are able to wage two complete wars on two different fronts simultaneously, which I think was a thing that worked really, really well when it just consisted of those guys with the little, pointer sticks pushing plastic figures around, like in the NORAD room.
Well, not to be cynical, but ultimately, really, this is probably what is behind repealing Don't Ask, Don't Tell, isn't it? Where they're just saying, we can't afford to kick guys out anymore.
We're running out of guys to send off the boat.
You know, We booted 14,000 soldiers out of the army over the past 5-6 years, 6-7 years because of the being gay.
Are you suggesting that our duly elected senators and congressmen in Washington would not do something simply because it was the smart and correct thing to do?
I'm sure that really ultimately it was because their hearts grew three sizes and they knew that it was the right thing.
It is the Rick Emerson Radio Program. It's Thursday, December 23rd, 2010. We're here with Anna Griffin from The Oregonian and Dawn Taylor, who is at the news desk.
It's deer season, and some hunters in North Carolina seem to be leaving what's left from the hunt next to the driving lanes. Carcass dumping sites are a horrible scene for drivers and frustrating for hunters who are following the law. Often spotted on rural roads, dumping sites are often filled with new and old animal carcasses, primarily deer. Lieutenant Matt Long of North Carolina's Wildlife Enforcement says, "Your first thought is, oh my goodness, was somebody killed here? The smell of death is everywhere. It's a terrible place."
I just want to get a soundbite. Okay, here's a little scavenger hunt, you kids. I want a soundbite of just the final part of that where he says, "The smell of death is everywhere. It's a terrible place." Because the thing is, the number of stories into which I'm going to be able to insert that soundbite in 2011 is like endless.
These dumping sites pop up across the state during this time of year. Wildlife Department says that the majority of hunters follow the rules, but it's the few that dump that leave a bad name and image for the sport. Officials recommend buying burying bucks or other carcasses. In other cases, hunters can use nearby farms where containers for carcasses are sometimes available. Dumping sites become a problem for the public when they end up in moving water. Long warns, this is somebody's water supply downstream. With the water temperature, it actually preserves it and it will last longer. It's like having food in your refrigerator. It lasts a long time.
You know, or you could just go to the store. I mean, you know, you could order a pizza. I mean, I don't want to think too far outside the box.
I hate to sound preachy and like some sort of crazy hippie liberal, but I think if you go out in the woods and you kill an animal for sport, you should be legally required to use every single bit of the animal, even if you choke on it.
Yeah, don't cut off the parts you want and then leave the rest of it lying around.
Somebody's still got a plate full of gristle. Get back to eating. I have said, this is one of those things where it's like, if I join in, then it's going to tip the scales and we're just going to be some crazy nutcase, liberal media appendix, which I'm fine with. That's okay. Because my family's just full of rednecks and hicks and whatever. So it's not like I don't see. I mean, there are pictures of me, as I think I've said, pictures of me holding a hunting rifle when I'm a very small child. My dad was like doing the thing of like taking me out like Iron John style into the woods so I could become a real man. And it didn't really have the desired effect. But And I'm also not like a vegetarian. I'm not a vegan. I mean, I am an omnivore, you know, like a great number of people. And I recognize the whole thing about, as Ted Nugent would say, that, you know, before you grill it, you got to kill it and everything. But here's when guys say, like, well, if you're going to eat meat, you can't be opposed to hunting. My whole thing is this. I recognize it's important to get my dog neutered, too. But, you know, if you ask a guy what he does for fun and he says, oh, I sit around and I cut the testicles off animals and then he just stared at you, you'd be calling to have that guy locked up like right now. Why? Because a thing that's necessary and a thing you do for fun shouldn't necessarily overlap all the time. So the idea that for amusement purposes you're going to go find something that's alive and shoot it until it isn't, that just indicates to me that, you know, that maybe you should reconsider some of the ways that you channel your daily frustrations.
Or maybe just not dump the body by the side of the road.
Yeah. Yeah. How about that?
I don't actually have a problem with hunting, but I don't want to drink.
No. Or drive by and, you know,
I don't
want to
explain dead Bambi to my children on the side of the
highway.
Yeah. That's got to be an awkward thing, too, if you're a parent. If you're a parent, is there some sort of horrible reverse? I was talking to Ryan White about this because Ryan came by on Monday. I don't know if you heard about this or perhaps just heard this. But he was here on Monday with his daughter, Stella, who is adorable and who really is charming and who was very well behaved for about the first 12 minutes of the show.
And then the smell of death was everywhere.
She was not poorly behaved. She was kind of wiggly. And
well, she's a baby.
I'm
not saying she had malice aforethought.
Believe me, I've seen like horribly misbehaving
babies. A radio studio is not really the place for babies.
I'm not complaining. And when I say poorly behaved, I mean she's like, she's like 6 months old or something. It's like, the behaving is the wrong warm word to use. But I mean, she was quiet.
Did you turn to her and tell her to grow up?
And he actually had said that morning, he's like, well, I got Stella. Should I come in? I'm like, sure, fine, no problem. And Dawn really did like a yeoman's job of trying to occupy her. Largely by letting her jam her thumbs straight up your nostrils and then pull huge chunks of your hair like until you were about ready to scream. So she was quiet and sort of composed. And then, you know, to her credit, it got sort of loud because we were doing a top five and there were, you know, suddenly all this music coming out of everywhere. And she started to wail a little bit and she kind of skedaddled home. And he said that was one of his first sort of experiences with taking her out in public. And then he felt like he had to sort of leave because she was causing a ruckus. If you're a parent, there must be just some sort of unpleasant reverse bingo board of the first time you have to, like, blank, such as the first time the kid, you know, sees, like, or, you know, detects the smell of death in North Carolina. You have to explain what that's all about.
Well, I am from North Carolina, and I will tell you there are many places there where you smell death. So, I mean, it's an easier conversation to have there than it is in Portland. There are all sorts of – it's like, why do I have this hair on my body? And what do I do with this thing that I just pulled out of my nose? And what is that bleeding corpse over there? And
what do you do with that thing that just came out of your nose? Let me ask you this, first of all. Let me just back up for a second. And you can stop me at any point.
Important is what you don't do with it.
Yeah.
Whenever you deem this inappropriate, you can just sort of let me know. In your household, do you believe in euphemisms for bodily parts or functions?
Not really.
Okay, so you just go with the straight-ahead clinical terms.
Yeah.
Good for you. Well done. Let's see. Santa Claus exists. Yes, no, or make up your own mind, kids?
Santa Claus still exists.
So is that a thing that you actively told them, or did society sort of inform them and you just did not correct them?
That's osmosis.
So they picked it up and you have not bothered to splain.
Because here's the thing. Threats and bribery actually do work as a parenting tool.
Is that true? Like Santa Claus is not going to – you're going to be on the bad little boy list.
Yeah.
Let me – and parents, if you are listening to this program with your children right now, this is not going to be anything inappropriate. But I will say that parents, if you are listening with your kids, you may want to just skip past this part or come back to it here in a bit because I don't wish to be – I don't wish to Scrooge anybody. So, Don Taylor, when if you believed in Santa Claus, when did you discover Santa Claus did not actually exist?
I'm sorry, what?
If you believed in Santa Claus, when did you discover he did not actually exist?
What are you saying?
I see. This is your dry wit on display. I didn't see the irony tag floating above this picture.
She's crying.
God, I don't know. I probably started to... I figured it out slowly over a period of time. It's like with me, it was like it is with a lot of kids. There's this point when you start to realize, like, it's your mom's handwriting on the tags. And then you say, if you say something about it, then mom says something like, well, Santa was really busy and he dropped off the presents and asked me to put the tags on them for
and you. Just like at a certain age, you just look at her and go, cut the crap.
Yeah. And then there's this point where you just start going, you know, wait a minute. This is the same candy in my stocking that's in the cabinet in the kitchen. Okay. I think mom's doing this.
So did you ask your mom at any point? Like, did you put her sort of in a corner and clarify?
I think I did. You know? I asked the usual questions. Like, I remember, you know, the whole thing about, like, why are there so many Santas?
Right.
You know, and why is there one at Sears?
She said there's Santa's helpers.
There's Santa's helpers.
Of course.
Santa can't be everywhere.
Right.
So there are guys who work for Santa and help him, but they send all of the requests to Santa. So, you know, it's like, well, okay, I'll kind of accept that. And then, yeah, gradually you start kind of going, you know, this doesn't add up.
See, this is one of the reasons I am so glad that I'm not a parent, because I just don't know how I would navigate. There's so many things that, like, it seems like there probably is some reality show in here somewhere where somebody is put into some Kobayashi Maru, of child having, where you have to try to figure out how to get yourself through these impossible situations, like the mommy, did you ever experiment with drugs? And then it's like that, you know, and mom is just sitting there going, no. And just, and like, no matter how well they have prepared for that situation, they just, you know, you, I think when it comes, when push comes to shove, you just never are sure that you're saying the right thing. So did you, Anna Griffin, did you ever query your parents about Santa Claus, or did you?
When I was 5 years old, all I wanted for Christmas was a Stretch Armstrong doll.
Is that true?
Yes. And at one point I walked in the closet and there was a Stretch Armstrong doll. And I said something to my mother about it, and my mom said something about, well, I had to get one before they, you know, why is this here? Well, they had one in the store, so I had to get, my mother began to stumble, and I just said, but I thought Santa brought.
Oh, and at that point, like, your Encyclopedia Brown logic had trapped her.
And now I see the you know, you can sort of see the parental face working and her trying to come up with an answer that would solve it, and it doesn't. It's the, no, I never used drugs. No, never tried that. But she didn't have it.
And did you, at that point, did it all become clear? Did the light bulb go off and you went, aha? Uh-huh.
It did, but, you know, I think a lot of kids go through a period where they intellectually recognize that this whole Santa thing is just – the physics don't add up.
It just
can't make sense. But still want to believe and want to make sure. You know, it's like getting baptized even though you don't really believe that stuff. You're just covering your bases. So
right.
I'm gonna
and also, you would think, you know, if I actually say out loud that I don't believe in Santa, maybe the presents from Santa will stop coming.
Right.
So how – sure. Santa brings them.
Well, it's, even as an adult, it's like, they're saying the whole thing about, well, there is no Santa Claus. Like, it gives me like a weird sort of, you know, like,
yeah.
It just feels right. It just makes me feel
stop
like
stop that. That's
it makes
right.
It makes me feel like a jerk, even just to say it. So, and there's a here's the other thing is there's a weird bell curve with the whole Santa Claus belief thing, and it is not unlike, I believe, I've had this theory for the longest time about. And because I can tie everything back to either Kiss or Star Wars. And I have this whole theory about why George Lucas released the prequels when he did, as opposed to just doing it, you know, like right after Jedi or something. And it's because there was, you know, it's like, you know, for my generation, there was people who grew up and they were, you know, they were children. They saw Star Wars and Empire and Jedi. And then they reached their teenage years where it's like you discover boys and girls and, you know, rock and roll and whatever and growing your hair and being a rebel. And you're too cool for all that stuff. But then by the time you're like 25, you know, or 26. Six or 27, you're an adult, might be married, maybe have kids of your own, and you're just like, and you know, and plus you're at the point where you just go like, F it, I like Star Wars, and you can get bent if you don't like that. And people had come back to re-embrace the stuff from their childhood that they were no longer embarrassed of. And Lucas went, aha, now is the time. And plus those kids all had, you know, they had kids of their own. With Santa Claus, it's like if you're a kid, you want there to be a Santa Claus. But then if your kid is in like second or third grade and going to school and telling the other children that there's a Santa Claus, then you know the kid runs the risk of just being a noob, you know, and he's just, you know, and he's going to get made fun of. But then you also want them to be able to like retain the sort of, you know, to conjure up the holiday magic within themselves when they're adults.
And you don't want him to be the kid who is telling other kids that there is no Santa Claus.
Right.
Stupid.
You don't want him to be like a little Gregory House just going to school and just busting everybody's chops about it. So, all right. Let's do one more. And then, you know, this is a perfect segue. I didn't even plan this, but for the sake of – I might edit it later so it sounds just as though I planned this. Wait, let's pause. I planned it exactly this way. And so we'll do one more story. We'll take a break because I teased at the beginning of the show that I had a Stan Freberg piece to play.
Indeed.
And it is actually about this very subject, about the existence of Santa Claus. So we'll have Stan Freberg's Christmas Dragnet here in just a few. And then we'll continue our discussion with Anna Griffin. We'll also do our top fives of the most coveted and sought after toys slash items of our youth. Here is Dawn Taylor.
We'll have a quick little taser watch, so let's do that.
Awesome. Here is your, I guess Anna Griffin's in the studio, so it's obligatory, your taser watch. Now for Thursday on the Rick Emerson Radio Program. By the way, I'm looking at this chocolate reindeer that Anna brought us, and I've noticed on the back that it says it's not just that it contains it contains what they call tree nuts, which is sort of interesting. How are tree nuts different from – oh, I guess peanuts are like on a shrub or something.
In the ground. They grow in the ground.
There isn't like a – okay.
Peanuts grow in the ground.
No. I'm not disputing. I'm just saying this is – we've just reached one of those – you know what it is? This is like occasionally when your GPS takes you to an unfinished road. And you realize, you know, or it's like one of those abandoned highway overpasses they have in Portland that like go nowhere because the funding ran out. I just realized now, as I was getting ready to say that, that I didn't know with any certainty where peanuts came from.
Oh.
So I just stopped and I'm backing up back onto the highway and we're going to continue down Taser Road.
And by the way, peanuts, part of the reason that you're confused, peanuts are not nuts. They are legumes.
Well, are all nuts legumes?
No.
Okay, we have to stop this now, because otherwise it's just we're going to go down this arterial into some blind alley of legume indecision that I'm never going to get out again.
Okay.
Here's Dawn Taylor.
In Chickatawaga, New York, which I actually looked up to figure out how to pronounce because it's spelled Cheektowaga.
And it's pronounced what?
Chickatawaga.
Excellent.
Nice.
Chickatawaga, New York. An apparent case of mistaken identity led to the wrong man being tasered at the Walden Galleria. According to the Buffalo News, Anthony Rose and Aja Brown fit the description of a pair of shoplifters last Friday. Police say both men resisted arrest and officers were forced to use their taser on one of them. A store manager then said they were not actually the culprits. However, both are charged with resisting arrest.
Okay, now.
And the one guy is also charged with possession of marijuana.
I have to. That's the worst day of your life. That sucks so.
Yeah.
That sucks and blows with such force that it can't. That you're being. Okay, let's just all stop. First of all, I have to ask this. So when the story says that they resembled the suspects, I mean. I think I probably know what that means.
Yeah, I think we do. I think we know what that probably means.
Is that, as they say on The Wire, is that where they're looking for a number one male? And the cop just goes, how about him?
We're looking for a 6-foot-tall black man between the ages of 20 and 75.
He may be wearing clothing.
Yes. Because if they had described them as youths, we would know what they meant.
So that sucks. And would you say it was in a museum?
It was at a mall.
Okay, it was at a mall. So they're just at a mall. They see some guys. They go, hey, you there. And then they probably, as they moved in for the arrest, I'm not going to say they drew the guns, but they probably did the thing of the hand on the hip, like don't start any trouble. And I would imagine in New York, in most places, if you are approached by anybody, cop or not, who is suddenly reaching for the gun, you have a whole lot of warring impulses there. One is just to like say, please don't shoot me. The other is to just get away from the guy who's reaching for the weapon.
And even if you weren't the shoplifter, but you know you have pot on you.
Yeah.
You're going, no, it wasn't us. It wasn't us. It wasn't us. It wasn't us. Please don't arrest me. Crap. No.
Because you are desperately trying. You're rifling through your inventory, like the mental index cards of what you can say that will end this situation before he pats you down.
Yeah.
And, of course, the more—
I'm right.
And hopefully the cops will be dumb enough. They'll fall for that. Oh. You are?
Oh, I'm sorry.
Well, then you can go, sir.
I'm sorry, sir. We had no idea.
What do you have to shoplift that they would send officers out after you and then the officers would taser you?
Well, but see, I think that it is—
I don't think it matters what you stole. If you resist arrest, they'll just grab the taser.
Especially because the taser, don't you sense like that there is, don't you think that the taser is like the Four Loko of police weaponry in that it is just a matter of time until there's some sort of congressional hearing or investigation into the use of tasers. And don't get me wrong, as I think you might have noticed, I love the use of tasers. All the time on anybody, guilty, innocent, black, white, gay, straight, Jew, Gentile, tasering for all. But it seems like these stories happen, and whether or not this is like a Summer of the Shark thing where the media is amplifying it and exacerbating it sort of falsely, it does seem like it's happening all the time. And you got to know that there's some Chuck Schumer guy out there who's probably going to call a hearing at some point to regulate the usage of these.
It's not being amplified. I mean, I have Google alerts on my news alerts for both the words taser and taste. And I get 12 or 14 stories, separate stories that come across every single day of people either being tased or lawsuits that are going on because someone died when they were tased. I mean, cops use these things like cattle prods to get people into the car when they don't move fast enough. They shoot people just because they don't want to be bothered to have to chase somebody down. You know, they're just using them at the drop of the hat because cops think, well, it's non-lethal force, so I can just use the thing and no harm, no foul.
And also, it must just be immensely satisfying from time to time. I mean, really, and I always go back to the video of the woman who wouldn't hang up her cell phone. And the guy's just like, he actually says, I'm going to tase you in the face. He actually says the phrase, I'm going to tase you in the face, because she's in the car, still belted in with the door shut and the window rolled down, but she won't get out. And she's doing the... No, there's an officer. No, he says I gotta get out of the car. Well, I told him I don't want to get out of the car, and he's off going, ma'am, I'm gonna tase you in the face. And she said, well, and then she actually just says to the cop, she says, hold on a minute. And then the next thing you just hear is just like screaming. It's awesome. It is so great.
Hold on a sec, honey. I have to get tased now.
I'm not gonna lie. It's like one of the best things I've ever seen in my life. And it makes me a horrible person. But you know what? Fine.
No, you know, when I worked at Starbucks and I was waiting for somebody to place an order and they wouldn't get off their phone, I would have happily tased all of those people in the face.
That's the thing. And so Anna Griffin, to answer your question, when you said what kind of shoplifting do you have to do to get tased, I think that cops, on the one hand, have a tough job dealing lots of times with innocent folk, but lots of times with just scum. Secondly, you know, there is, I think, a legitimate fear for your life sometimes if you're a cop where, you know, you never know who's got a gun and who's going to, you know, who's going to try to run and just, you know, shoot you or something. And thirdly, I think they must know that the clock is ticking and those things are going to get taken away. And you can't just be shooting guys willy-nilly because then, you know, as we found out in Portland, that's, you know, they have speaks with you about that. Tasing, though, it seems like
they won't really punish you for it or anything. But, yeah, you know, they'll talk to you about it really sternly.
But you get yelled at a lot.
You will be declined service at your local anarchist coffee bar.
But I think with the tasing, I think it's just like you figure like, well, we can probably just, you know, they're just going to give us a warning or something. Just do it. And I'll keep an eye. I'll make sure nobody has a cell phone out. And if they do, we'll tase them too.
Is it your turn or my turn?
Yeah, really. I mean, that's the thing. You know,
you and
the
guys big,
is it
yesterday.
Okay if we both tase them? No, we probably shouldn't.
And
both
the guy
tase
said, okay,
them.
If I say rutabaga, you've gone too far. You have to stop. All right. Okay, just go. Because it's a matter of time. It's like those non-lethal weapons they have in L.A. Like that thing they spray you with now. It's like it's like the liquid insulation that you spray on and then it turns to foam and hardens.
Like, it's like silly string that covers a guy.
I would be shooting people with that day and night. This is the reason.
You'd come in and you'd just shoot me just to do it.
If I had it right here, I would. Yes, I would. This is the reason I don't own a gun, because I'd use it. I'd use it on somebody. I'd use it on many somebodies, probably.
You would threaten the dog with it just to scare the dog if the dog wasn't behaving.
I know enough about myself not to give myself access to certain things because I would misuse them, and I can't be alone.
I'm feeling less Christmassy than I was when I walked in here.
We have Christmas stories coming up, so that'll change.
All right, well, there's your taser watch for God bless us, everyone. There's your taser watch for Thursday. Guy has no idea how much joy he's brought us. You are listening to the Rick Emerson Radio Program. Still to come, we'll do your Joy of Christmas. Dawn Taylor and I will do sort of respective top fives.
Yes.
The top five most coveted or sought after toys from when we were youths. We'll talk more with Anna Griffin from The Oregonian and so forth. Don't forget, coming up tomorrow, our Christmas Eve special featuring Tim Riley's Frank Sinatra Christmas. I teased this at the top of the show, and it seems appropriate now. So we're going to do this, actually. It's in two parts of, I think, because it was on a, it was originally issued as a 45. So I think it's in two segments of around 2.5 minutes each. We started the show with Tom Lehrer, who is familiar to many of many novelty record enthusiasts and followers of the Dr. Demento show, for example. One of his colleagues and one of his generational cohorts in terms of recorded comedy, and a guy who was a huge inspiration, made a huge impact on me when I was growing up, is Mr. Stan Freberg. You're listening to the Rick Emerson radio program.
You're listening to the Emerson News Network.
This is the season. My name is Wednesday. My partner is Frank Jones. The chief is Captain Kellogg. December the 24th, Christmas Eve, they brought in a guy named Grudge. When I heard what they booked him on, my blood ran cold. It was a 409-6325-096704. Not believing in Santa Claus. 4:35 p.m. I was working the holiday watch at a homicide with Frank.
Hang up your stocking yet, Joe?
Yeah, just before I come down. You too, Frank?
Always do. Hung it up early just in case I have to work late tonight. Wouldn't want to miss out when Santa Claus comes, you know.
Mm-hmm, sure wouldn't. Be a shame.
What you gonna do tomorrow, Joe? What you gonna do on Christmas? You got any plans?
Nothing much.
Why don't you come by the house, Joe? We're gonna have Christmas dinner. You know, all the trimmings.
Mm-hmm.
Turkey, celery stuffing, oysters maybe, chestnuts.
Mm-hmm.
All the trimmings. Cranberry sauce. Love to have you.
Mm-hmm.
The missus always fixes a plate of relish with them little carrot sticks. You know, olives, pickles, scallions. Most folks call them green onions, but they're really scallions. Did you ever notice that, Joe?
Ever notice what, Frank?
How most folks call them green onions, but they're really scallions.
Mm-hmm. Scallions.
Anytime after two, Joe. Love to have you.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'll see.
Love to have you.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'll see.
The missus always fixes a plate of relish with them carrot sticks. You know them little carrot sticks?
Mm-hmm.
Olives, pickles, scallions.
Mm-hmm. Let's not go through that again.
Love to have you. Go through what again, Joe?
How most folks call them green onions, but they're really scallions.
Oh. You noticed that too, huh, Joe?
Homicide Wednesday. Mm-hmm. 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 Mm-hmm.
What's the matter, Joe? What's the matter, Joe?
Bringing a guy in a 409-6325-096704.
You mean?
Yeah. Guy don't believe in scallions. I mean, Santa Claus. 6:29 p.m. We questioned the guy who didn't believe in Santa Claus, a guy named Grudge. Says here your name's Grudge, is that right?
Yeah.
You said you didn't believe in Santa Claus?
It's hard to believe what you said. Did you really say that?
Sure I said it. How do you know there's a Santa Claus? You got a picture of him?
No, no mugshot.
Any fingerprints?
Mm-mm, no latent prints. I just know that's all. It's like saying there isn't an Easter bunny.
That's another guy there ain't know of.
Mm-hmm, well, that's your story, mister.
Joe, he just said that to make me feel bad, didn't he? There really is an Easter bunny, isn't there, Joe?
Listen, Grudge, didn't I pick you up 3 years ago on a 1492 for not believing in Columbus?
Yeah, I don't believe in Cleveland or Cincinnati either.
How about Toledo?
I ain't made up my mind yet about Toledo.
Okay, mister, I get the picture now. You don't believe in nothing, do you?
Nothing. And you want to know something else?
What's that?
I'm going to get up and I'm going to walk right out of this room, because you guys ain't got nothing on me. There ain't no law against not believing in Santa Claus.
There is in my book. Let me tell you something, mister. I'm going to prove there's a Santa Claus if it takes me all night.
Yeah, pretty funny. The police department's got nothing else to do.
Let me straighten you out, buddy. This one's on Frank and me. Right, Frank? Right, Frank?
There really is an Easter bunny, isn't there, Joe? You know, hippity-hopping down the bunny trail?
It is the Rick Emerson radio program. That is part one of Stan Freberg's Christmas Dragnet, or Yule Net, as it was known at the time. We'll have part two, the climactic conclusion, which I guess is two ways of saying exactly the same thing, of Yule Net in just a moment. The Rick Emerson radio program brought to you by, among other fine businesses, Squires Electric. Find out more about them at squireselectric.com. Okay, so we'll resolve this on the other side of the resolution of that here in just a second. But just now, as we were starting the Christmas Dragnet, so Anna Griffin said something about, you said, I'm surprised there isn't a toy taser, which is just, and it was like immediately just a cacophony of light bulbs popping in my head. Because now, does the toy taser exist?
Doesn't seem to. Anna said that there was one in Japan.
Was it your thing that would shoot candy?
Well, that was my idea.
That's great. I'd buy 100 of those.
I'm looking here at a Japanese company that sells it's called a Lovely Pink Seal Stun Gun. It's a lovely taser. And it's.
Are you sure that's not just an actual taser for ladies who want something that's perhaps a little more stylish?
No, I think it is actually a pink stun gun.
It's shaped like a seal, and it looks a little bit like a sex toy, and it says here, give electric shock to crazy Japanese businessman, pink seal charm. Ouch.
Okay. Yeah. Hold on a second. Now this is because this. Let's just be honest.
So that's
here.
An actual taser that looks like a toy, as opposed to a toy taser.
Now, okay. I'm trying to work this through. So this is a. This thing you found online is a taser shaped like a seal, shaped like a sex toy, sold to women to shock businessmen in Japan.
That's what this, yes, I'm, this, that seems to be what I found.
Something so deeply warped in the fabric of that country.
And there's an important notice. Don't use it to a person who has a heart disease. Don't put it on the delicate part of the body.
Now, is this a thing to stop the guy from groping you on the subway because it's a big problem? Or is this like for the man who wants a little extra zing in the bedroom?
This looks like it's to stop the crazy Japanese businessman who's had a little bit too much sake and you guys are in the bullet train together, yeah.
Because there is a thriving market in sex toys that resemble like dolphins and squid and like Hello Kitty and whatnot.
Now I will say I did find apparently a Russian site or something like that where they sell a taser that is designed to use on kids. It has a lower voltage.
The Tasler.
It has a lower voltage. It says, guarantees you'll have children that obey every command.
Why am I just now finding out about this?
You'll have the best dressed and most respectful children in your neighborhood or your money back.
Man, when I was going to Utah, you have no idea how handy that would have come in. So you were suggesting that there be a taser that shoots candy. Here's the other thing you could probably do, and this is a thing you could make now with existing parts, somebody out there. You could actually just make a taser that just shoots silly string. You know, sort of a novelty taser, but it just shoots harmless strands of fun, as opposed to lethal strands of electricity that will stop your heart. So, okay, somebody out there needs to, I'm telling you right now, I'll find the money. I'll get venture capital for this. I will find the seed money for this venture.
And it'd be fun because, like, if you're, like, sitting across the room from somebody and you want some tasty candy, and you're like, hey, here, you could just shoot the taser at them and it would go, whee, and it would fly across the room.
Did you say you want some tasty candy?
Some tasty
candy. No.
Which reminds me, by the way, you completely missed the fact that my religious nutcase watch was about a woman who saw Jesus
on a nut.
In a nut.
All right. See, here's the thing is I'm always tripping and falling into puns when I don't mean to, and then I sometimes fail to see the puns that are laid right in front of me. Well, in any event, so this observation about about Junior's first about the littlest taser on earth is brought to you by Squires Electric, folks who know a thing or two about electricity, as Scatman Crothers would say. Hey, just speaking of this, and it's not really about this at all in any way, but you didn't really expect it to be. Mm. Speaking of this, which reminds me of the Don't Mess Around With Electricity, as voiced by Scatman Crothers, which then in turn reminds me of Mr. Kite. And Mr. Kite, the public service announcement that aired throughout the Northwest and that is one of the tells for whether or not you were raised here. Anna Griffin, you probably don't know who Mr. Kite is, but that's okay. He was a guy in a big sort of like a mascot outfit, but it was a kite. And he was to tell children if their kite got wrapped around a power line to leave it alone. And it aired all throughout the 70s and 80s in the Northwest, and it's vanished. Nobody's been able to find a copy of that TV PSA. And it's sort of one of those things that you reference, like, you know, it's like a shibboleth to prove that you are from here. Here's another one. Do you all, because Dawn, you're from Southern California, mm-hmm. and Anna, you were from, I want to say, New York, but it's just outside New York.
I am from Connecticut by way of North Carolina.
Connecticut.
Yeah.
So did you get, are there Payless stores outside of the Northwest, or is that just a Northwest thing?
No, it's national.
Do you guys have did you have the Merry Christmas from Payless jingle?
Well, now, Payless, the shoe store?
Well, I think it was, there is a Payless Shoes, which is an offshoot of the department store in general, but the Walgreens-esque store.
Yeah, because we had Payless drugstores in Southern California, and then I think they went out of business, and then I came here, and I was confused for a while because we didn't have Payless shoe stores in Southern California, so that was
the drugstore came first, started stocking shoes, and then they spun the shoe store off into its own thing.
Oh, wow. I didn't know that.
Yeah, that is true.
Okay.
So did you guys have the Merry Christmas from Payless jingle?
No.
All right, so I think this may be another Northwest thing, and a guy emailed me the other day about this, and it was weird because I was just thinking about it. It is this jingle, and I'll play it here once we're done with the Christmas Dragnet. So I hate to be that guy, but we'll finish Christmas Dragnet. We'll play the Payless jingle on the other side. It's real short, but it is for anybody who lived in the 80s in the Northwest. It's one of those. It's like a Tom Shane spot. I mean, it's just like you hear it, and it's just it is part of your cultural DNA if you live here. So we'll get to that here in a few. All of this stuff. All of it brought to you not just today, but the last few weeks, the last few months, better part of this year, by our fine business partners, including Squires Electric. So do yourself a favor, either now or in the new year, contact them for electrical wiring, Ethernet wiring, wiring issues or difficulties, replacement, repair of any type. Squires Electric, 503-252-1609 or squireselectric.com. Fully licensed, bonded, and insured electrical installers, inspectors, and supervisors. You'll talk to their charming, if occasionally foul-mouthed office manager, Donna, who shocks us now and again with her salty talk.
She showed me a shot glass when we were down there giving them a gift basket, and she had a shot glass somebody gave her that has a little Mexican man on it, it's like three-dimensional. It's like a little clay guy that's baked and then glued onto the shot glass. It was a little Mexican man in a sombrero with an erection. And she said, "You want to see my little Mexican man with an erection?" And she shows me this. And I was like, "Why, yes, Donna, that's indeed what that is."
SquiresElectric.com or 503-252-1609. The Rick Emerson Show continues after this conclusion to Christmas Dragnet.
You're listening to the Emerson News Network.
I took Grudge over to the helicopter, got in, flew around the city for hours. I showed him department stores. What's hurrying in and out of those department stores, Grudge?
Happy people, but I ain't impressed.
I showed him stockings. How are those stockings hung, Grudge?
By the chimney with care, but I didn't hang none up.
I showed him children nestled all snug in their beds. What's dancing in her heads, Grudge?
Visions of sugar plums. But you ain't selling me. There ain't no Santa Claus.
He still didn't believe. There was only one thing left to do. My job, get to the North Pole. 11:45 p.m., we arrived at the North Pole. I set the plane down. We walked over to Sandy's workshop. Rang the bell. Pardon me, sir. Can I ask you a few questions?
Why, sure. Just tickle me to death.
What do you do for a living?
I'm a brownie.
What are you doing at the North Pole with a southern accent?
Well, the boss sort of ran short on help this year, so he had to recruit a few of us brownies from the South Pole.
Mm-hmm. That figures.
What a waste of time.
Could we talk to your boss, please?
Oh, he's out. You would come on the one night he's out in the whole year.
Mm-hmm. What's your particular job, Mr. Brownie?
My boss has 8 tiny reindeer. My job? Feed them.
Mm-hmm. Yes, sir. What do you feed them?
Well, most times I fix up a little plate of relish. Olives, pickles, and them carrot sticks. You know them little old carrot sticks?
Mm-hmm.
And scallions.
Most folks call them green onions, but they're really scallions.
How do you know?
Just a stab in the dark. The little man showed us through the workshop.
My boss will be back for the second load pretty soon. Say, would you all like to hear an interesting story?
Yes, sir.
Will you see that huge pile of presents over there?
Mm-hmm.
Man, look at all that stuff.
Would you believe it? They're all for the same man, been piling up here year after year.
Why didn't the guy ever get them?
Yeah, why?
Because he didn't believe in my boss. You know the rules.
Mm-hmm, we know.
I don't suppose there's no chance that this guy can still...
get the presents? Oh, sure, he gets them all the minute he believes. But I don't suppose he ever will.
Too bad about that guy. What's his name?
Don't say it. I don't want to hear it.
Come on, Mr. Brownie. What's his name?
His name? Grudge.
The Brownie saw us to the door, wished us a Merry Christmas. We were heading back to the plane when it happened.
Hey!
Yeah, Grudge?
You know that guy I said I didn't believe in?
Who's that?
Santa Claus?
Yes, sir.
You think I'm too old to change my mind?
You're never too old, Mr. Grudge.
Well, then I believe in Santa Claus and Columbus.
How about Cleveland, Cincinnati, and the Easter Bunny?
Yeah, them too.
And Toledo?
I still ain't made up my mind yet about Toledo.
Look, Grudge, up in the sky. He's coming back for the second load.
It's Santa Claus! It's Santa Claus!
There's the only guy I know can make everybody happy in one night.
Yeah. He must have the biggest heart in the whole world.
That's about the size of it.
It is the Rick Emerson Radio Program. One of these days, we shouldn't do it all the time, but one of these days, you know, just as like a little bonus, we should just leave the mics running, Watergate style. Maybe not going out during, you know, like the song or the spot or whatever, but just, you know, just sort of like as a downloadable feature later on. God almighty. Today is not that day, by the way, just FYI. It's the Rick Emerson Radio Programmer here with Oregonian columnist Anna Griffin. She writes a twice-weekly column about life in Portland and in Multnomah County. What is coming up next in your fine paper from your quill, Anna?
I have a fairly large story running a Saturday's column, a profile of the publisher and editor of the Northwest Examiner, a fine little neighborhood newspaper.
Is it one company that has the Northwest Examiner? Because there's a Southeast Examiner, I think.
The Northwest Examiner is its own standalone.
Its own entity.
Owned by one guy. Yeah.
It's the Northeast Courant.
Yes, the Picayune. The newspapers like that, and it's so easy to be sort of reflexively snarky about small newspapers and community newspapers and newspapers for a very discreet area. But, you know, but it really is, they're charming, and I don't mean that in a mean way.
Well, the problem
way.
Is that many of them are very bad.
Yeah, a lot of them are.
And here in the Portland area, too, we've suffered for many, many years from them all being owned by the same concern and overseen by the same man, and them all suffering from the same weaknesses.
Now, I didn't know is that the case, or is that a thing you're making up out of spite and bitterness?
No, because...
Which I'm fine with.
When I used to work for the Clackamas Review and Oregon City News, we were purchased by this concern and folded in with... many of the other fine community newspapers.
Oh, is that our doctor friend?
Well, then our doctor friend purchased the concern that owned all of the, let's call them, community newspapers.
Yes.
And then hired that guy to be in charge of everything.
Yeah. Okay.
And then people say, wow, the Portland Tribune's not a very good paper.
I wonder why.
Oh, see, now we were just speaking in vague generalities. Now they've cracked your code. You've blown the cover.
Yeah.
Yeah, that guy... Well, all right. Yes. Yeah. No, I'm with you on that. But if done well and if done with care, which I think is really, I mean, that's the kind of paper that is done either terribly or wonderfully, because people either don't care about it at all or they really, really, really are devoted to it.
And neighborhood newspapers that work usually because of one person. That's the case here. You know, Northwest Portland is a great, vibrant example of what Portland planners want the place to be, and has a long tradition of quality block-by-block local journalism. And Bud Clark, the former mayor in the 70s, started a newspaper there because he basically felt, you know, people, neighborhoods are what make a city special, and people feel better about their neighborhoods if they know what's going on. And so this guy that I'm writing about for the weekend, Alan Clausen, is kind of continuing that tradition.
How long has he been? Has he been doing it?
25 years.
Wow.
No.
I mean, that's just. I mean, it's. It's a longer discussion that we have time for, probably. But I. But in a way, I mean, you know this better than I. But in a way, you feel like. How do I put this? You feel like. To whatever extent, certain industries, and you know, it's not like radio is any different or TV or whatever, but to a certain extent, you know, all entertainment-based or media-based industries are unstable. Always have been, always will be. To whatever degree they can be made more stable, or you can try to weather some of the weirdness that happens in technology and in the economy. It's probably things like places like that, where maybe you have the best shot at it, not because he's got a ton of money, but because he's able to adjust more quickly, and he's able to navigate around some of the hurdles that sort of just pop up.
Well, and what's interesting is that we call it hyper-local journalism, is the hot thing now. I mean, AOL is spending millions and millions of dollars starting incredibly local one or two zip code websites where they will tell you everything going on in your community, and the Oregonian has kind of retrenched itself in the past couple of years to be hyper-local. And ESPN is going into various cities and starting local websites. And this guy has been doing it very old school. You can read the Examiner online as a PDF. You can't. That's what he's got.
Awesome.
In terms of web presence. But, I mean, he's basically doing what the rest of us are now coming around to realizing that, oh, this might be what people want.
Well, good for him. You know a great website that has been gone forever now, and I don't know why they didn't stick it out. Microsoft, of all people, had a great website called Sidewalk. And it was Sidewalk, dot like your city, or I guess it was Portland dot sidewalk or San Diego dot sidewalk.com. And it was an MSN thing, and it was their attempt to do sort of a like a hyperlocal portal, like a Yahoo that was tailored just to your, like, to your neighborhood, to your zip code. And it was really, really great. They had it when I lived in California, and then they just continued it. And it's so even then, I think people sort of saw that you had to, that was the only way you could. And that's the thing they said about radio forever, that radio has just disregarded and continues to disregard, which is that you are never, ever, ever going to win the money arms race unless you are the largest, richest company. And even then, those companies, you know, as Clear Channel found out, that they get some reversals that bite them in the ass. And so the only way you can really deal with that is to be – it's like – here's a great example. You're from SoCal, radio station KNAC. And KNAC, which is there's a legendary hard rock station in Southern California, which is, by the way, an incredibly underpowered – you couldn't even get the thing if you left the parking lot. I mean, it was like it had so little reach, you know, for most of the time. Anyway, that I was familiar with it. But the way that KNAC really worked is they targeted, and this is like 20, 25 years ago, they targeted a niche and a specific slice of the culture and of Southern California, and they just hyper saturated it. And that's the way that it's got to be. That's the way everything's got to work.
Well, there's another station, successful station in Southern California, and very, very small, KCRW, which is out of, actually, their studio is at Santa Monica City College. But the thing is, like, I actually now have a web app, an iPhone app, so I can like listen to all of their programming, because they have just amazing, they've always had amazing music shows. They're the ones that produce Harry Shearer's show, Le Show, which has been on for like a good 30 years now. Henry Rollins does a weekly talk show at a KCRW. But yeah, it's a really small, really low, super low budget station out of Santa Monica City College. And thankfully, you can actually listen to it on the web now, and you can get an iPhone app for it, because their actual, you know, broadcast range was very, very very small.
If only we had a community radio station here that didn't hate Dawn Taylor and fire her. Okay. It is the Rick Emerson radio program. We're here with Anna Griffin from The Oregonian. Just a moment, we'll do our top five. So Dawn and I, we're going to do each sort of a top five back-to-back of just the – which, by the way, is sort of ad hoc, because it just sort of hit me at like 11:30 this morning. Because I was trying to come up with another Christmas song list, but it's like we've kind of done every variation on that, and I've been playing them all week anyway. So we'll do the top five toys that we most coveted growing up, and Anna Griffin would weigh in as well, because I could see the wheels turning like as soon as I mentioned it. We'll do that here in just a few. At the news desk, it is Dawn Taylor.
And now, from the news desk, this is Dawn Taylor.
Well, revisiting a very disturbing story that we talked about earlier on Legion of News. A laboratory at the University of Osaka is running an ongoing study on evolution and has revealed that they've produced a genetically engineered mouse that tweets like a bird. They've produced more than 100 of them, as well as a mouse with short limbs and one with a tail like a dachshund. It's all part of a larger study into how genetic mutations drive evolution.
The mouse with the short limbs really got the fuzzy end of the lollipop there. Because the mouse that can tweet, hey, he's a bird. The mouse that can sing. Mouse with the long tail, he can probably like grab things with it or whip it around. The mouse with short limbs, he's just sitting there.
He's just a little Tyrannosaurus Rex of a mouse going, I can't reach anything.
He's just not moving. He's just like a seal, basically. He's just kind of going, rawr, rawr, trying to get to another rock.
Please hand me the cheese. Very sad. These are all diverse outcomes that have come about as a result of miscopying DNA. The researchers didn't engineer the mouse to tweet, although there was genetic tinkering involved. The lab created the mouse as part of what they call their Evolved Mouse Project, which genetically modifies mice to be prone to miscopying DNA. And then from there, they just breed them for generations to see what happens.
And see, when you say miscopying DNA, I know that that's true, but that also makes it sound like it was an accident, which it was maybe an accident that the mouse tweets, but it's not an accident that they miscopied, like the DNA went wonky.
No.
Like, that was the whole point.
No, the whole point is just to say, well, you know, if we change the sequences of the DNA and they don't copy correctly, what'll we get?
Let's see.
There should be some evil laughter behind this, shouldn't there? Tiny armed mouse.
I mean, it's, it does seem like, where is your God now? You know, is the mouse is just sort of like, I can't really reach any. Can you, you tie my shoes? You know, it's just not able to do like anything. And the thing we were talking about is like, imagine if you were the first guy, like, you know, you go in every morning and you turn on the lights and you make coffee and, well, let's see what Project 75-Y/J is up to. You know, and every day it's like you're Will Smith, you know, and you're just going like, no, I guess the test subjects are unchanged. And then one morning
the lead researcher was checking the newborn mice one at a time and came across a mouse that was singing like a bird. Yeah. And then I'm sure he, like, screamed and
imagine
dropped it.
Imagine looking down at a mouse just whistling at you.
Tweet, 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 tweet. Oh, my God, you're a mouse.
I mean, I would immediately be pressing that, like, Walking Dead button.
Am I a mouse or a monster?
I mean, right? Isn't that when you press the total decontaminate switch?
It's gone too far.
This story, I demand and am horrified by the possibility of video. Like, story is useless without video, but it's like, I don't want to see it.
The tweeting mouse.
Yeah. I mean, it's like that thing about that video of the crow figuring out how to make, like, tools out of, like, wire and then how to use it to open a jar or whatever the hell that thing was that went around the internet a few weeks ago. And it just, I so wish that I had never seen that. Because now I know. I've always suspected the crows were evil, but the thing is, now I know.
A video.
Oh, I don't want to.
There's a video of the mouse tweeting like a bird.
Why are you telling me this?
Well, think about this. The crow is busy.
Don't play it before warning me.
And you are in your basement playing Call of Duty. I mean, in the end, the crow's going to catch up.
That's true. Let's be honest. I think the crow has already started to. He's already caught up because we could have stopped the crow uprising. But instead, we spent our time creating, you know, like a video game where I can see the pores on Michael Rappaport's face.
Okay.
Oh, God. Is this the mouse that tweets
this
like a bird?
This is a mouse that tweets like a bird.
I think we should vote on whether we want to play this or not.
I vote yes.
I vote no.
I want to see it just to see how you handle video on a radio program.
Fine.
Sounds kind of like a dolphin.
It is somewhere between a mouse.
Oh, that's very, that's tweety.
Okay, it's not as unnerving as I thought because I guess maybe there's more similarity between mouse squeaking and bird, you know, tweeting than I really thought about. But still, you can hear how that is like evolving into something that's not quite right.
Yeah, and the thing that they are
also,
fighting is that...
Also, by the way, Dad is caught in the well, just in case you're wondering.
The way, you know, birds sing is not haphazard. They actually communicate with each other with strings of sounds, which is it's what they call ordered noise, kind of like human speech. And so they're hoping that seeing how the mice have evolved to tweeting will actually help us learn something about how human language evolved.
This seems like a horrible idea. I don't think we want the mice communicating with each other.
It's the worst idea ever. Because, I mean, let's be honest. Can we be honest about something? We're basically, we've been committing like a mouse genocide for like 50 years, you know.
And how many generations is that in mouse life?
Thousands.
That goes way back.
I mean, they start talking to each other. It's like, hey, I can tweet like a bird. Oh, yeah, well, they gave me a dachshund tail. Oh, my God, they grafted an ear to my back. Let's kill them all.
And then suddenly Frankie and Benji take out their horrible vengeance on the rest of us. I mean, we are basically
Attica! Attica!
That's so much better than the Battlefield Earth joke I was going to make. Awesome. Oh, God. Doesn't it just seem horrible, though? It just seems like the worst idea. It was like, if you had just made like a dolphin that blew confetti out of its blowhole, like that would have been at least interesting. This is just terrifying.
Well, this is the sort of thing that you imagine scientists do. Like, well, let's just screw with their DNA and just let them keep breeding with each other and see what changes.
What?
And you think, that would be horrible. Why would they do that?
There are things that could be useful. I mean, we could be, it's like stem cells. I mean, there are things you can,
yeah.
I could see medical science working on mice like this to see how we grow limbs if you lose a finger. But the tweeting like a bird, just I don't know what we gain from that.
They're going to make a spider that can use an abacus next. That's going to be the thing.
And already then got the spider goats.
Oh, God. Why did you have to remind me of that? You're a horrible person. You're an awful person. It's bringing just horror and strife and tension into my brain every day.
And when the army of genetically modified tweeting mice and tool using crows
and spider goats.
Abacus using spiders come to get us.
This is like that story about the guy who's building that robot that can detect the human pain threshold and when it's been passed, which we're not making up, by the way.
Yeah.
And I swear to Christ, they're testing, the robot is learning because they've got to test, they're building a robot that can detect when human pain threshold has been reached and exceeded. And I swear to God, to train it, they literally just have the robot in a basement all day punching people. To be fair, the researcher's one of the guys being punched. But still, and then, I swear to you this is true in the story, then they just started giving the robot a pointed object and having him like stick the guy with it.
Yeah, because the idea is to teach the robot so that it will not do things that will hurt people.
Uh-huh.
because if the robot knows when it's hurting people, it won't go any further beyond a certain point. But to find out what that point is, they had to make a robot that just punches guys.
And yet, see, here's the thing. He's wincing, but a robot with a taser is Rick Emerson's dream.
I guess. But, I mean, that's only when it's serving my agenda and my purposes.
How about a robot with a candy taser?
If this is a thing that I can use, like in Kiss Meets the Phantom of the Park, to take over Magic Mountain, like Anthony Zerbe, then I'm all for it. But that's not how it's going to be, though. It's just going to be – and I'm not going to be like the brave Michael Biehn guy who's like, you know, running in a blue light, stepping on skulls at the beginning of the film. I'm just going to be one of the skulls. I mean, I know me. I'm weak. I'm a spindly man with no survival skills of any kind. Jesus. All right. Was that even a watch? Was that just like a terror watch?
That was
watch?
Just a terrible story that made you uncomfortable.
Okay. Can we do anything else at
let's
all?
Let's go to the Joy of Christmas.
God. All right. Here's your Joy of Christmas for Thursday, December 23rd. I'm so sorry, Anna Griffin.
We wish you a Merry Christmas. We wish you a Merry Christmas. We wish you a Merry Christmas.
Let your children listen to the show, do you?
Oh, God.
Okay. Thank you.
We do have listeners that let their children listen. Ugh. Jenny Hieronymus, for example, yeah. Telling us that her daughter was like, I'm so glad Rick's back on the air. I missed the penis watch.
She also, by the way, she also trained her daughter when her daughter was two. She also trained her daughter to kiss the screen and say daddy whenever she saw Tom Cruise on television. So there you go. The mind of the Rick Emerson listener. Here's Don Taylor with Joy of Christmas.
Several retailers are staying open around the clock through Christmas. Shoppers like these headed to a Long Island, New York Macy's in the wee hours of the morning were on their way to beat the crowds.
I figured it's the best time to shop. Nobody's here.
I'm working all day, so I don't have any other time to shop.
I mean, I know I'm tired. I'm, like, sleepy. But, I mean, if I don't get it done at 1 o'clock in the morning, I just won't get it done tomorrow in the day.
I'm sure the other drivers on the highway appreciate the fact that you're speeding to and from the store on no sleep.
These shoppers were willing to trade in some sleep in order to beat the big crowds.
Come here usually the last 4 or 5 days, and I usually show up around 11 o'clock and shop.
We wait until the last minute so we can come in the middle of the night when no one's here.
Okay. I should have something pithy to say, but I think I'm still back on the mouse.
That's okay. He may not have a sleigh, but one local man dressed as Santa Claus depends on his three-wheeled trike for spreading Christmas cheer and making a living at the same time. But 2 days ago, at the intersection in front of Sean O'Brien's computer and cell phone repair shop in Safety Harbor, Florida.
Is Safety Harbor, Florida misnamed?
I believe so, yes.
And it's also where?
Florida. He was stopped by authorities from Pinellas County. Code enforcement said I was not allowed to ride a bike on the sidewalk or ride a bike with signs on it, said Santa O'Brien. Code enforcement supervisor Mike Funk said O'Brien was warned not to ride his bike on public property, and if he continued, he could face a fine of up to $1,000.
How old is Mr. O'Brien?
I'm not sure.
Is he one of God's special people?
He might be.
Okay.
I mean, if he's going there to and from work, that's fine. But if he's riding back and forth or around the area, that's a violation of code. O'Brien's already been warned about parking his van overnight in front of the store because of advertising signs on the vehicle. The businessman said he's frustrated. He's been advertising like this for 5 years, apparently dressing up like Santa and riding around on his trike. With big signs saying, you know, come to his cell phone and computer repair store.
How is he at the store and simultaneously riding a trike around the neighborhood?
I think he's riding around in front of the store outside.
And then he presumably stops and goes inside. And
if someone needs something fixed, I guess.
There's so much about this story that I feel like we're missing, the genome sequencing isn't quite complete on this story.
With the down economy, he says now he really needs to spread his message. I think, in my opinion, freedom of speech and advertising, I'm just expressing myself. This is my First Amendment right.
This is the guy on the track. Well, you were just saying, Anna, during the break, that your daughter is now, she now sees Santa everywhere, but it's not actually guys who are really Santa. It's just like guys with beards.
I just like that. It's not actually guys who are really Santa. No, it's not, Rick.
It's just like homeless guys. And
exactly.
Just, you know,
yes.
All right.
Yeah.
So, or this guy. So this is really where it gets sticky with your kid and telling your kid about Santa, because then they assume that, like, the irritating, shrill guy on his trike is the same as, like, the jolly guy from the...
No, honey, that's just a dumbass trying to sell you a remade cell phone.
Yes. Yeah. All right.
When I was on my way here today, actually, and I was stopped at the light, like right down the street. I was right across the street from Jeannie's, the cafe there. And while I was stopped at the light, a guy came riding along, and he's one of those guys that he rides a bike, and he's got a big box thing on the back of the because he delivers food for some like natural co-op thing or something or other, and he was completely dressed like Santa. So he's riding a bike with a big delivery thing attached to the back, dressed like Santa. He makes a left and like just rides up onto the sidewalk past Jeannie's, and God help them, this is Portland. Not a single person sitting there in the restaurant looked out the window and gave the guy a second glance.
No,
because honest to God, a guy dressed like Santa on a bike making deliveries is nothing we don't see every day.
It really, the number of things that I mean, it's like I don't like that, like the jagoffs on the tall bikes. I don't even see them anymore. It's like I've developed a filter in my brain. It's like a ticking alarm clock. It's like the second thing you have it, you stop hearing it.
Every time you see one of those guys, though, do you ever notice they all have that look on their face, that smug look? Like, I know you're all looking at me because I'm on a big, tall bike. They're also proud of themselves.
They are what Philip Roth would call urban attention seekers. They're like the guy. Like, you used to see, I mean, not very often, not as much as the tall bikers. Like, you used to see the guys riding, like, the bicycle with, like the huge front tire and the tiny little rear tire, you know, like they were out of a Sears
or
robot
guys
catalog.
Unicycles,
or it's like the guy who's really like he wants to make sure that you see that he's wearing loud golf pants and a Naga hide jacket.
I remember my husband saying once, and this was something I used to collect things my husband said, and I started a blog for a while. But it was he pointed out that, you know, guys on recumbent bicycles, they all have that smug Ed Begley Jr. thing going on.
They really do. That's totally accurate. Did Patrick say that?
Yes.
That's awesome. And the thing is, even if that tells you, that's a great cultural shorthand, too, because I know exactly, without further conversation, what he's trying to say with that. So, yeah. So F those guys is really what I'm saying.
All right. And item the third.
All right.
Holiday decorations hanging high from above are supposed to make people feel jolly, but it certainly didn't in this case. A giant candy cane in Centennial, Colorado, fell from a light pole and crashed into Phil and Jessica Goodrich's car. The accident happened earlier this month at a strip mall parking lot in Centennial, Colorado. The four-foot candy cane caused significant damage. It seriously dented the roof and hood and broke the windshield, enough to total the 1991 Toyota Corolla and throw a wrench into the family's holiday plans.
This is also one of those things that sucks for her because there's nobody who's going to take the story seriously. They will all laugh as she's trying to get estimates for the car or she's trying to get it towed, and she's going to have to put up with a whole, like, every jackass with a tow truck or with a repair shop is going to have like a one-liner he's going to use.
Every time I was like, what happened to your car? A giant candy cane fell on it.
I just like that because it's in the newspaper business around this time of year. Invariably, an editor will send out a message reminding people not to write a stupid holiday-themed lead. And that was a case where they just couldn't. Billy Bob wasn't in the holiday spirit this week. He murdered his wife and children, that kind of thing. And that's sort of that fit nicely in the oeuvre.
The insurance company for Colorado Lighting, the company that hung the decorations, says it plans to send the family a check to cover the damage, but it's been weeks and the family has been without a car. The Goodriches are getting around on foot and taking the bus, but Phil says it's affecting his business. He needs a car to drive to clients' homes for personal training appointments. I'm losing $150 to $200 a day, he said. Couple doesn't know how they're going to be able to pay their rent, much less buy gifts for their two boys for Christmas. So, ho, ho, ho.
Merry Christmas. There's your joy of Christmas for Thursday, December 23rd.
Merry Christmas. We wish you a Merry Christmas. We wish you a Merry Christmas and a Happy New Year.
You weren't here yesterday, I think it was, when we had the story that Christmas is apparently the most lethal day of the year in the United States. Apparently, every form of death is
well,
up.
You get that taser out of the box and you want to use it.
I'm telling you right now.
It's not a sex toy, honey. It's a pig taser.
We're going to look back on this day, though, and we're going to say, like, and that was the moment that it all began. And, you know, you're just sitting, just being interviewed in front of huge bags of money, you know, while cheap knockoffs of our candy taser.
Popping candy tasers.
Just flood the market. That's a brilliant idea. It's like that for, you know, and the thing is, it only has to be in the market long enough to make you the money. And then, unlike the Four Loko guy, you don't hang on. Once you start to get legislated out, you just run. Like that guy.
You get the cease and desist letters, and you go, well, I've already sold 100,000 of it. It's like, okay.
And you know what? You find yourself a good shell company, you can handle a lawsuit or two. It doesn't matter. You get people for that. Well, it's like, you know what I saw? I was at the Buffalo Exchange, I don't know, a day or 2 days ago, something like that. And where, by the way, I got waylaid by a homeless guy who managed to chisel a dollar out of me. And he did it, and I had to give it to him because he actually – I forget what the sentence he was, but he actually – he used what Tony Robbins would call an open-ended open-ended tie-down, which is where it was a question – that required a response from me. And it wasn't this, but it was something like, do you know what time it is? Or like, is it 3:30 yet or whatever?
Or where are your hoes?
And I, where's your bitches?
Where's your bitches?
And I stopped, and it's like the next thing I knew, I was like 5 minutes later, and the guy was going, so then they're going to charge me $1.25 for a cot. Look at me. Do I have $1.25? I don't think so. So if you got a buck, and I was, finally, I just, you know, and it's like he kept me there long enough. He just wore me down. But, and I did encourage him, by the way, just to skip the whole rap in the future and just to go right to the I need booze, you know, because that's a thing that really is going to work on Hawthorne. But I went into Buffalo Exchange, and you know what they had there, speaking of lawsuits? They had those shoes that are like also roller skates, where the roller skates just come out of the bottom.
Nice.
But you want to talk about a company that lasted about 4 minutes before the first Gloria Allred phone call started coming in. That's what it is with the candy taser. You make it, and then you get out before the phone starts to ring that way. Was that our joy of Christmas? Are we done with that?
That was it. We're done.
All right, so we're going to do our top five, and then we'll wrap it for the day, and Anna Griffin can be free of this terrible place.
I never even got to talk about like coming into work and finding the
stripper card.
The stripper card.
Or
was
it a stripper card or a hooker card?
It's a hooker card.
Because Sarah was in Vegas, so I imagine she brought that back with her.
And it's a double-sided hooker card, and it was puzzling me. Because,
same hooker both sides?
No. It's two different. On one side, it is for a fabulous Las Vegas escorts.com, and there's a picture of Danielle, who is blonde, and apparently has glistening nipples, because you're allowed to show somebody naked, but you have to put a little starburst thing over their nipple.
I wonder what college she's working her way through.
She is offering a $99 special. On the reverse of the card, we have Carly, who we see sitting in a different position, kind of from behind. And her website is listed as, and I'm not making this up, vegassescorts.com.
Please dispel.
Subtle.
V-E-G-A-S-S.
Oh, not vague as in indistinct, but like Vegas. Vegas.
Vegas. Escorts.
Okay. Sorry.
.com. And Carly is offering a $69 special. Now, I can't figure out, and I was actually thinking about this earlier today when I came in, trying to figure out why Carly, what Carly does differently that is $30 less.
Let me ask you this.
Danielle does.
Are they the same? And I can't really see from over here. So are they? Are they the same in appearance? Are they?
Well, Danielle is blonde, so maybe you get $30 more for being blonde.
Are they both white?
Yes.
Are they both, similarly proportioned?
Yeah, as far as I
can tell. I would imagine improbably so.
Danielle may have bigger fake boobs, but they seem similar enough
to me. I'm trying to figure out if there's some sort of, if there's some sort of a market difference that they're, there's the, actually, strangely enough, the Freakonomics guys in their sequel, in the Super Freakonomics, they did this whole thing about Chicago prostitutes versus they actually did both ends. They did high end call girls, and then they did streetwalkers. And
I just like the phrase "they did both ends."
Zang. By the way, I'm glad that I asked just earlier the blanket you don't let your kids listen, because now I can just be crude with impunity and not have any sort of lingering Catholic guilt about anything. But they surveyed the call girls and then the streetwalkers, and they asked them for like the period of like 6 months to, after every trick, come back and answer some questions about like what and how much and how did he pay and did he haggle? Did he pay the first amount? Did he want to use a condom? Did he not? And they really came to a lot of striking conclusions about guys who seek out a specific kind of act or sometimes a specific kind of girl that was then directly tied to whether or not those guys would haggle. Like guys who were looking for X would be flexible on how much they would pay. Guys who were looking for Y, they would be like, I'm going to pay this and no more.
So some guys were anal is what you're saying?
Thank you. Yes, they were.
And speaking of which, see, this is the thing, is that I'm looking at this and like Danielle is $30 more and she's blonde. Carly as dark hair, and she will cost you less. But the thing is, she's the way she is sitting, and the fact that her website is vague as escort.
Now is that
there's
not...
sort of an implication there to me that perhaps she would.
Oh, this is back in your okay. Your whole yes.
Allow you to do.
Well, I'm thinking that.
That would cost more.
It's the $99. It's like a special, right? That Danielle's offering. So maybe there's several things included in the package.
All right. Well, if it were earlier in the day, or perhaps if the composition of the room today were slightly different, I might actually just call the number and try to figure out the difference. We'll save that for another time.
Is it the same number on both sides, or would you call a different number for Carly?
Here's the thing.
It goes to the same place.
The last two digits are different.
Yeah.
So that's the same switchboard. Same switchboard and probably just a different – it probably is not even – probably the same switchboard, same operator.
Right.
But it's like, you know, if you look at a 10 – if you look at a 10-line bank of phones – those all have different phone numbers.
Yeah.
It's just a rollover system. You're right that Carly's positioning and the vague-ass escorts.com does indicate perhaps the willingness to perform a certain sexual act that maybe Danielle might not be willing to
But you think that would mean that Carly would be – that Carly would cost $30 more.
But see, here's the thing. You are assuming that the $69 you're paying there represents all surcharges, fees, taxes, and the add-ons. Mm-hmm. I would imagine now – and I would admit it if I had. But I have – you know, I've never gone to a hooker or anything like that. So I don't know. But if Mayflower Madam is to be believed, it seems like you get in the room and then suddenly it's like when you're buying a car. And suddenly like the guy's like, well, the undercarriage coating – legally, I can't let you leave here without the undercarriage coating and the seat warmer. You don't
What's
want
nice
that.
What's nice is that these are all sort of double entendres that you're throwing out.
Yes, they are.
So for the $69, you know, you're not getting the leather seats
I would imagine
or
that,
the air conditioning.
That gets her in the room with you. That's what I would imagine. And I would imagine that once she's in the room with you, especially because this is in Vegas, not Reno. And in Vegas, prostitution is illegal. And they will, like, bust your ass for that. Like, in Vegas, they don't – it's really weird that in Vegas they have a hard line about prostitution.
And yet there are these cards apparently available everywhere with naked women on them and phone numbers.
And I think that's for the women and for the companies. It's just the cost of doing business, you know. But they also know that if you're a John, you are very unlikely to go to the cops in Vegas because the cops in Vegas, it's like, you know, Clark County has one of the most restrictive and draconian drug laws in the country. Like for simple possession of pot, you can get between 5 and 10. They don't really do it that often, but you can. And it's because they don't want anything to take away money from gambling. That money could be going into a slot machine instead of a slut machine.
Also, they have the most amazing forensics lab. I've seen it on TV.
And they're all good looking there. Except it's really dark there.
It's always really dark.
How do they look at – I mean, they need lights, don't they?
I've always wondered that.
It's dark and glowing blue everywhere.
And they never turn on the lights when they investigate anything either. They just turn on their flashlights and they always think, there's a light switch. Why don't you
And there aren't
on?
A lot of them, but they're very good at their job.
Yes.
I would also imagine that the other thing is that they don't – that Vegas is probably because of their history and the nature of their businesses – and the fact that prostitution is like legal in Reno, that they don't want to bring any like federal heat down on them about whatever. So they hold a really hard line. So as a result, I would imagine that's why the prices are so low. Because I'll tell you what, if you call like the Mustang Ranch or something and you ask how much, they're going to be like, well, 5 to start or whatever. You know, they're not going to say like $99. That's because that gets her in the room. And then once she's there, you are so terrified that you're like, oh, my God, I'm here with a hooker. What if my wife finds out? What if they go to the cops? What if I have to go to the cops? What if she robs me out of whatever? And then you're just willing to pay any amount to ease over the wrinkles in the transaction from then on. That would be my guess.
How much to just cuddle?
You know, I am so – here's the thing.
I just want to chat.
I really do find stuff like that fascinating. Like there was I think it was actually Sidney Barrows who talked about this guy who just – he wanted just girls to come over, not to be nude, topless girls, to cut his hair. And if he'd recently had a real haircut, to just pretend to cut his hair. Like to just walk around their fingers and go like snip, snip. And then no actual sex, and then he would give them like $500 and they would leave. And I just that to me is so much more interesting than a guy who just wants to like, you know, shtup a blonde girl. All right. By the way, just confident, and I'm not gonna we won't belabor the point here, but just confidential to like Danielle specifically, but also to the fairer sex from me, and I would imagine not a few men. Just really just eat the here's the thing. There are almost no implants. Of this size especially that are realistic or appealing or sexy in any way. Just stop with that.
And that's like the she figured that was the best picture she had because that was the one she was going to use on the advertising card.
No.
And her breast, what you can see of her breast there from the side, it is weirdly lumpy and misshapen.
It seems like a thing that they ought to be removing, maybe in a ward of some kind where everybody's wearing a sort of like an inhaler so they don't catch whatever weird airborne melanoma you've contracted. I won't say as a blanket statement that like implants are always bad because by definition, how would I know? Mm-hmm. Because if they're good enough, I guess you're fooled. But I mean,
that one, not so much.
Yeah, I mean, unless you're guaranteed that you're going to get the great implant, and it seems like you're probably not. Just go with what I think. Guys, they'd always prefer you just go with what you have. You know, so I can really only speak for myself there. But I mean, I'm just saying. All right, we should move to the top five here.
Other side is the bad implant.
I like the carefully placed star.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, the star over her butt. So that you don't see.
You don't want to traffic in crudity.
No.
And Carly with two E's. And I have always wondered, strippers and strip club owners and hookers, why can't they spell?
I don't know. And why do they have to, like, put a heart over all the I's in their names is the other thing.
Because they're friendly.
Can I just tell you that there's a guy I used to work with when I was in Salt Lake, of all places, a guy I did talk radio with. And I found it's one of those things where it's like, I wasn't looking him up, but it's like that thing on Facebook where it's like recommended to you. It was like a friend recommendation because of somebody else. Anyway, so I'm like, oh, I haven't thought about that guy forever. I'll click on see what he's up to. And I swear to God, so he now is divorced and he's – this is what you don't want your life to become. He is now divorced, running a strip club in just outside of Provo, which I mean like the mind reels. He's running a strip club outside of Provo and I swear to God, like his little Facebook quarters, whatever, is living the dream. Don't be that guy.
On the other end of the scale, though, I will say we have a listener, a longtime listener from the Rick Emerson Show who friended me on Facebook, and I friended her back, and she is a burlesque dancer. And she is actually part of a burlesque troupe and does the old school, like dancing and stripping with the boas and the things like that. And she is awesome.
Is that burlesque troupe that's at the – they were at – I think it's called the Star Theater downtown, but then I think they moved to the Hollywood Theater.
No, this is in like Arizona.
Oh, really?
And they're at a place called the Surly Wench
I know
in
who you're
Arizona.
Talking about. That's
– Her name's Stormy.
Yeah, because that's – she has her real name and her stage name or whatever, and
right.
It's Stormy because I always – the first few times I wondered if it was Storm. Yeah.
Yeah, and she is just – like gorgeous,
she
and
really
all
is.
The women in their group, or their troupe, are really gorgeous. And I love what they do. I love that it's not the creepy like just standing there and humping a pole and having men stick. I mean, they're putting on like theatrical productions and dancing and wearing like amazing costumes, and it's awesome.
Don't get me wrong. I'm passing no judgment on strippers or even on the guy who's running a strip club, really. It just seems like if you're going to be, quote, living the dream and you're running a strip club outside of Provo, where, by the way, and I can tell you from experience, they show nothing there. I mean, really, you need, if you're living the dream, your dreams need to take a step up. I would say you need to adjust your dream state. I got nothing
it's
against...
It's a Richie Bristol sort of living the dream, really, isn't it?
It's just, stripping, hooking, whatever. If I could do it, I wouldn't be here. So I got no problem with that. If I could be doing that, you'd be listening to a lot of wind on the microphone right now. All right, we should do the top five. Here's your top five for Thursday,
five,
December
four,
23rd,
three,
2010.
Two, one, fire.
Counting is wonderful. Counting is marvelous. Counting's the best thing to do. Counting is happiness, counting is ecstasy. I love to count, don't you?
It is the Rick Emerson Radio program. Today's top five. So we're doing something a little bit different today. Today we are doing the top five songs the top five toys or items that you coveted as a child. The top five toys that you wish to be given, and maybe you were, maybe you weren't. Usually I would say not, because those are the ones that you tend to covet or think about years later. The toys that you long for but never got. So Don and I each kind of came up with a list. Did you get
I did.
Was it difficult or was it easy? easy.
It was difficult, although the truth is I didn't think of very many that I didn't want. I do have a couple that I didn't want, and then a few that I actually did achieve and are memorable. So,
we'll ask Anna Griffin to contribute to this list here in just a moment as well, and I came up with five. We'll let you start.
Okay. So
these are Dawn Taylor's top five toys or items that she wished for as a child and may or may not have received.
Okay, I don't even know what order to go in these, but I will say the first one that I thought is a skateboard. When I was in the fourth grade, I wanted a skateboard desperately, and I begged for a skateboard. And now, I don't know how much I've talked about this on the show, if people are aware of this. My dad was crazy.
He may have mentioned something about that.
Fireman, and like a lot of firemen, he had a lot of time on his hands, and he really, really liked to make stuff. So he decided he was not going to buy me a skateboard. He was going to build me a skateboard. So he got wood, and he put like some fabric down on it and fiberglassed it, kind of like a surfboard. And then he got wheels from like roller skates and put them on it.
So cute and sad.
And it was so lame, and it was so poorly built. It was actually pretty sturdy, but it was not something that maneuvered like a skateboard.
My wife has talked about this extensively, actually. Your parents getting you, not getting you what you want is one thing. Your parents trying to get you what you wanted or getting their version of it and getting just off ever so slightly.
Yeah.
Like she talked about when she was like, I think maybe just getting ready to be a teenager. She was, 11, 12, something, and kind of conscious of style and peer, whatever. And she wanted a radio. And her parents got her an AM radio, which, of course, and whatever that was, she wasn't going to be listening to a lot of Sean Hannity or anything. So there's really no point. So getting an AM radio in 1980 something, not cool at all. Or, asking for roller skates, and then her parents get her, the lame, Mickey Mouse roller skates that are for children, and she was, 12. Getting the thing that just... And then when her parents try to make a gift, and you, years later, admire the effort, but as a kid, you're just horrified.
Yeah. And then it's then I have to, take this thing out to play with all my friends, and it's like, yes, here I am with my weird-looking skateboard that my dad made.
I am sad for you. These are Dawn Taylor's top five coveted toys or items as a youth.
Oh, am I doing all? We're not trading back and forth?
We can trade off. All right. Well, we'll start with mine. Mine for honorable mention, and it is an honorable mention because I did get one some years later, a used one that was kicked down by one of my older relatives. But that was, of course, the Atari 2600 or the Stella, which I didn't get really when it sort of was at its zenith. It hadn't, the economy, for video games hadn't quite cratered, but it was right before that because I think my cousin, bastard, who I've mentioned before, the way, who received most of the time duplicates of his toys. And I don't think it's because his parents were thinking he was going to collect. It's just because he was like a corpulent little bastard who broke everything he was given. And so they would just get him you've got one, two would be even better. Have another Stretch Armstrong. And so I think he'd moved on to the Atari 7800 or the 5200, or the Intellivision or the Coleco Atom or some crap. And so he just, here you go, poor younger relative, have my leavings. And I was like a pilot fish to his sort of toy-based shark, just sort of taking whatever fell down. And so I got it. It was all kind of grubbied up and it was whatever, but it was still freaking fantastic. I mean, it was really, really great. And I am, I am old enough to remember seeing all of those commercials on TV for the Atari 2600 games. I can sing a lot of jingles from Atari 2600 games. I know an astonishing amount of Atari trivia about the games, about the company itself, and that was really one of my big, as dumb as it sounds, one of my big introductions into tech or computer or geek culture was through the Atari 2600, because my mom was kind of going through a sort of zealot phase right then, and we didn't get to. There were a lot of movies and TV shows and stuff we weren't allowed to watch because she felt that they were not virtuous and whatever. The 2600 was my entree, though, into that world of sci-fi in many ways. It was books and the Atari. So anyway, so there you go. So the honorable mention, because I did get one, and it was a few years late, but it did arrive eventually.
Thanks.
Dawn Taylor.
Okay, I guess for me, the next one. So we're doing honorable mention and five?
I did six, but yeah.
Okay, I can do six. Well, number five for me, and I should have probably swapped these out, but... they were called Click Clacks. It was the stupidest toy ever.
Sounds familiar, but I don't remember what they are.
And everyone demanded one. It was a hard, two hard resin balls on strings attached to a ring. And you went like this, and you hit them together up and down and up and down and up and down, and they made this horrible, loud knocking noise. And
your parents loved you.
Well, and I just, everyone, every kid I knew demanded them. I think the commercials were probably like incessant. And I remember I did actually get them. And after Christmas was over, we all brought them to school.
Oh.
And they ended up outlawing them at the school because every recess we'd go out and it was just like clack, 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 all over the thing. And of course, then you'd like sort of lose control of one every once in a while and smack yourself or one of your friends
awesome.
In the head. And they were about the size of like a golf ball and hard as a rock. And so, finally, after like less than a week, the school sent home a thing and said, the kids can't bring the click-clacks to school anymore.
What a terrible idea for a toy.
Oh, yeah, it was an idiotic toy. And it was one of those toys that its popularity lasted like the blink of an eye.
It was the snap bracelet of its day.
But it was the silly bands of its time. But at the time, it was like, there was nothing in life that was more important than I get the click-clacks.
Awesome. Let's see. I'll try to keep mine a little bit, because I can just see that this is going to be another 9 hours of conversation. And Anna's doing that. What time is it again?
Places to be.
I would say number five. I never really got any. I never really got any Star Wars stuff again until much later when I got a lot of them sort of hand-me-downs. But the thing that I coveted more than anything else. I mean, there was the Millennium Falcon and whatever. But I wanted the Death Star with the trash compactor because it had the trash compactor with like the handle and you'd screw it, and it was filled with little foam garbage. And then you would put Han or Luke in there and Leia, and you'd turn the thing and then it would squish the walls, and which is I mean, I guess in retrospect, a little morbid, but as a kid, it's weird because you have no filter for those sorts of things.
Yeah.
And the idea of just crushing your figures to death in a huge trash compactor is awesome. I mean, it's fantastic. And so of all of the Star Wars things, that's the thing I remember wanting most. That and an IG-88 figure. Go figure. So I have no idea, I don't know what that was all about.
Hard to find.
Yeah.
Hard to find.
So there you go. The Death Star with trash compactor.
Yeah. Well, my number four would be my freshman year of high school. I got an actual stereo. No more just like listening to a little AM radio next to the bed. My dad, as he bought all of my electronics, because nothing ever was cool. Everything my dad almost getting something, he would get it for me, but he'd buy it from Radio Shack.
Yeah.
So I did have like this stereo that was like this one-piece unit that had the turntable on top and a cassette and an 8-track.
Audio box.
Yeah.
So yeah, and that was mark of quality.
And that was something. I mean, it was like that sort of, it's from Radio Shack, but at least I have a stereo.
Better or worse than getting something from Kmart?
About the same,
yeah,
really.
Yeah, that's what I thought, too. Let's see. Number four. Number four is... this is the last time I'll say this, because otherwise it'll just become a thing. Again, most of these toys I got to see occasionally being used by my cousin while I was plotting his death. So, Death Star with trash compactor. And then number four, the Shogun Warriors. Now, Shogun Warriors may not sound familiar, and I think I'm getting the name right, because it's one of those things that I saw as a kid, and I looked it up later on. If you don't remember Shogun Warriors, you may remember them. I've described them this way. They seemed huge, but they were probably, I don't know, maybe 18 inches high, foot and a half high, maybe two feet. They were sort of like... They were like action figures, but they were giant. They were huge action figures. So if you had like a little, like a G.I. Joe-sized Voltron, it was proportioned that way. But then you would make it like a foot and a half high, and the great thing about them, and a thing that they would never be allowed on the market now, tiny, tiny little pieces that would come off as missiles. They shot little missiles like out of their chests, and like one of the Shogun Warriors actually made a Godzilla. There was a Godzilla Shogun Warrior, and for reasons that were really never adequately explained, his whole fist would just fly off. It was spring-loaded, and you could shoot this hard plastic fist across the room.
I tell you, when the movie Mars Attacks came out, I got some Mars Attacks toys, and one of them, they had like little Martian guys that had guns, and they had projectiles that jammed into the guns, and one time, and they did shoot, and they shot far, and they shot hard.
Oh yeah!
And I was actually playing with, and honestly, I'm like a grown woman at this point, and I was putting one of the projectiles into the gun, and I didn't like push it in far enough, and I let go, and it like shot me in the eye, and I had that moment of like, honest to God, that little Ralphie moment, where I swear to God, I was afraid I'd shot my eye out.
Did you really? I mean, did you ever?
It was so painful, and I was just like,
Did you tell anybody, though? I mean, did you?
Well, I told my husband, and he just shook his head sadly.
Okay. Because I was going to say, if you do that as an adult, it's a thing where it's like, not only have you, hey, you're lost an eye, but also then you have to tell people, I was playing with a toy, and I put my eye out. So if you just wait in a dark room for a while and see if it fixes itself?
I think Patrick was in the next room, and he heard me scream, and he came running in, and I had one hand over my eye and the other hand holding the alien guy in my hand. And he's like, what happened? I was like, this time I saw the eye with the alien.
I'm a big child.
Yeah, so.
Let's see. Number three on the my top five of the toys that I most coveted as a child was a game called Crossfire. Now, this is sort of a tie. I put Crossfire / Crossbows and Catapults because they were basically the same game. And they were games in which you would hurl objects into big, you know, into other objects. Crossfire was sort of like hockey, but instead of... it was like the reverse of Hungry Hungry Hippos. Rather than gathering up the little balls off the board, you would just... You had a little gun that fired balls onto what looked like a miniature hockey rink, and the goal was to shoot the puck by force of these little ball bearings into the other guy's net. Crossbows and Catapults was a game where you would build a fortress or a castle, and then you would use, yes, a crossbow or a catapult to launch plastic projectiles and hopefully knock down the other guy's fortress and capture a flag. Just things where you could slam things into other stuff. That's what both these were. They were really, really simplistic and just made for the angry preteen mind. So, and I got neither of them, by the way. Lon Taylor?
Number three for me is from the age of probably 13 or 14 all the way through high school. Every year for Christmas, I wanted rapidograph pens, which were a...
spirograph?
No, they're actually professional mechanical drafting pens that you can actually buy, like, you know, disposable pens now that draw very consistent permanent lines. But back, you know, in the day, you had to use the rapidographs. And I fancied myself an artist. I did a lot of cartooning. And if you wanted to draw, like, you know, dense, even lines, and they came with specific point, every possible point width
right.
You could imagine.
Got it.
That, you know, and so, yeah, and they had, like, little cartridges, and you had to refill them with the India ink, and they were a huge pain.
I think I saw those, but I never knew what they were. Now I know.
And I would always ask for them. My mom would buy me one or two, and I remember one Christmas, I think I was 15, my mom actually bought me a whole set, which had, like, seven different ones with different point widths, and that was just, I was the happiest girl in Puppet
Land. So she got you the thing, she didn't go like, how about a protractor instead?
She actually figured it out.
How about a doll?
I bought you some Bic pens. They're just as good.
How about something gender appropriate for once, Don? You are listening to the Rick Emerson Radio Program, counting down our top fives of items we most wish to receive as a gift as a child. Number two, for me, the Monster Maker Kit. So the Monster Maker Kit, and I hope that I am referring to this correctly, because there was the thing where it was like, and I know there was some girl equivalent of this, where you laid paper over like an embossed thing, and then you traced it or whatever, and the image, you know what I'm talking about, where it was like you laid the crayon on its side with the plates. That's not what I'm talking about. The Monster Maker Kit was, again, one of those horribly inappropriate things when you look at it through adult eyes. It was a thing they would sell to children, and they were little plastic skeletons you would put together. Once you had the little plastic skeleton put together, you got big tubs of, like, goop, basically, and you mashed the goop onto them.
I had one of those.
And you basically... Yeah, so you created little humanoid anthropomorphic life forms. You would get the skeleton, and you would basically put this sort of, like, a gelatinous putty sort of substance on them and create, like, a full person or monster.
But you would mix the powder with the stuff to make it, because the powder was basically baking soda.
Yeah. Exactly. And so you would make these little detailed monsters or people, and then you would drop them, because it was baking soda, you would then drop them into this mysterious melting substance, which was like vinegar or something, and then the flesh would just melt off their bones.
The thing would bubble up, and then the little bones would all disassemble and float up to the top, to the surface.
It was so great, and again,
it was
like
awesome.
Everybody wanted it. We never knew anybody who had it. I mean, did you?
I had one, yeah.
See, you're the only person. We all wanted it.
Best thing.
It was always like rumored that a kid in the next town had one, but nobody ever got to see it in person.
And really, it was like a one-shot toy. You do it, you do that, you go, wow, that's really cool. You do it two or three times, and you've played with it.
Yeah.
You've done it. You're not going to keep doing it. But still, it was very cool.
I wanted that thing like nobody's business. So, I'm just saying.
Well, in a similar fashion, my number two was the Mattel Thingmaker, which was... another horribly inappropriate and dangerous toy, which was essentially a heating element that would get super hot.
I like it already.
That came with metal plates that were molds. And you would get the stuff that was called plasti goop. and you would put it in there, and it would, like, cook the plastic and make little toys. And you could make, like, there was one that was the Creepy Crawlers set that made, like, bugs. There was an Army Man set that you could actually... You could actually put little wires in them if you wanted them to be bendy, and you used the green Army Man colored plastic and make your own little squishy army guys. And there was also ones that you could actually get instead of the plastic goop. There was stuff that was like some kind of sugar substance, and you could make the things edible.
Edible.
And, so, and that was Incredible Edibles was what that one was called. And you're supposed to make little cute. And of course, I got the sampler. My mother actually bought it, but they bought the sampler one where I had one army guy plate and one bug plate and one candy plate, which meant I could make candy army guys and I could make edible spiders, which of course I did. And it was awesome. And I burnt myself about 47,000 times because the thing was incredibly dangerous.
Anna, you're not done shopping for your kids yet. It sounds like this is an item that screams out to be owned.
Here's actually some pictures of it on somebody's nostalgia site so you can
baby's
see.
Baby's first hot plate.
Wow. Yeah.
Awesome. I vaguely remember that, and I remember wanting it. So you had all the cool things, Don. Damn you.
This is my top five out of an entire lifetime of not getting crap I actually wanted.
Let's see. So the number one most coveted item, and I think I speak for a lot of people my age, and maybe I don't, but I've discussed this before, and a lot of people go like, oh, my God, totally. So I think I'm onto something here when I talk about the green machine.
Yes. Yeah.
The green machine, which was like a super big wheel. Yeah. And the big wheel, which is a sort of sit-down plasticky tricycle. It was huge. Yeah, so, right. So Anna's doing the whole... Yeah,
and it was longer and skinnier.
And it had these handles in the middle of it that did something mysterious. Like it was an ejection seat or something, or a levitating, you know, device. The green machine was this giant version of the big wheel that was presumably for older kids or larger kids maybe, but I think it was for the older set.
Or kids whose parents had better health insurance.
Yes. It was, you know, sort of like if you were, you know, somewhere between the big wheel and the bike, you got the green machine. And the only time I ever saw one in person, there was a kid down the street who had one. And I remember some friends and I, like, looking through, I mean, this sounds like impossibly like the Sandlot, but just looking through the fence at it. And just kind of going like, I wonder what it does. Maybe he'll come out. And it's like we would linger by that fence waiting for him to appear and just sort of like, even just we could just watch him use it. Because we didn't even really want one as much as we just wanted to know, like, what is the deal? Like, what does it do? What do the levers in the middle do?
We know it's cool, but we don't know why.
I still have no idea what the things in the middle do. It's just a mystery to me. And so I've been fascinated. And I almost don't want to know now. So, if you're texting me or sending me, like, I just leave it alone. Because it can't possibly be as magical as it seems in my memory. So that is the most coveted toy from when I was a youth.
Okay, so just a little background so that you understand why this was, like, my favorite childhood gift ever. I was about 10 years old. My parents always purchased, when they purchased nuts, they always purchased mixed nuts. The horrible, salty, mixed nuts with the walnuts and the Brazil nuts and all this stuff. I, 10 years old, I only liked peanuts. And my mother would get angry at me for picking out the peanuts. Plus, I did not like the Spanish peanuts with the skin on them.
Right, the little wrapping.
I liked the dry roasted peanuts. So I was very fussy about this sort of thing. And I was always complaining about the whole nut situation. Christmas, when I was 10 years old, one of my gifts, my mother got me an entire jar of dry roasted peanuts. Just for me. And it sounds lame, but it was like, to this day, it was like one of the most awesome presents I had ever had, that I had an entire jar of dry roasted peanuts, and I got to take it with me into my room, and I didn't have to share it with
anyone.
And
you could eat it either slowly or all at once.
Yes.
That's fantastic.
And that was like the best Christmas ever.
Awesome. No, I can appreciate that. I really can.
That's good parenting.
I really, and I am a big believer, not like I have any kids, but I'm a big believer in the whole... My mom would do that occasionally with something like we couldn't have a lot of sugared cereal, but every now and again she'd like buy a single box of like Trix. And her whole thing was like, make it last or eat it all like in an hour. I don't care, but like, I'm not getting any more. Like, that's it. Like, when it's gone until like 2 months from now. And I think that was actually really great because then it was like it allowed you to learn to modulate your own indulgence. But also it's just awesome because you don't have to share it with anyone.
Yes.
And it's exactly, unlike all of the other, you know, lame attempts at gift giving that parents sometimes do. You know, and there's lots of stuff parents give you that is great, but you tend to sometimes to latch on to the things that are so slightly off. That's a thing that is exactly what you wanted. It is exactly what you wanted to get. So, excellent. Fantastic.
Thanks.
Anna Griffin?
Yes, Rick.
Was there anything that you coveted, any toy or item you especially wanted as a child?
You know, I suffered from being the older child and the girl, and so there were many things that I wanted that my brother wound up getting, the giant Playmobil pirate ship with the real canvas sails and the first Nintendo with Super Mario Brothers, and I hate him.
Okay, then.
But now you can get those things for yourself because you're an adult.
That's now right. I can deny them to my children.
That
even
too.
Better.
You can do what a friend of mine does, where occasionally he'll just I shouldn't name him, but a friend of mine who is otherwise, I swear to God, like a well balanced normal adult, will occasionally just go into the candy aisle of like a Safeway or Fred Meyer or something, and if there's like a kid, you know, and kids will just sort of linger and sort of stare, you know, at all the candy, you know, like, you know, just like eyes just like saucers. And he'll kind of go and he'll stand next to the kid and he'll just kind of go, you know, I make a lot of money. I could buy every piece of candy in this aisle, but I'm going to go buy lettuce. And then he'll just leave. And I don't know what that satisfies in him, but he does that every now and again. So, all right.
It does not make the children respect him.
No, probably not. Anna Griffin from the Oregonian, thank you for joining us today. The next piece runs Saturday.
Saturday.
So you can read her in print in the Oregonian or online at OregonLive.com. Join us tomorrow when our guests will include Mr. Big Jim Willig. He'll be here with another installment of Comedy 101. Tomorrow, he's going to be talking about the life, legacy, and career of Foster Brooks.
Yes,
That is tomorrow. Humor Me, Comedy 101. We'll also be playing our Behind the Christmas special, Ebenezer, I Barely Knew Her, and Tim Riley's Frank Sinatra Christmas. After a brief musical interlude, today's Legion of News will encore, followed by an encore of this very fine radio program. Thank you all for listening. The Rick Emerson Show comes to you live each and every weekday from the studios of the Emerson News Network, high above the milk packing district here in glorious southeast Portland, Oregon. At the news desk, Gon Taylor, advanced technology and magic provided by Mr. Thomas Gill, executive producer Bruce Aglow, chief of staff Cheryl Kanakoa. The Rick Emerson Show made possible by a generous grant from you. It is Thursday, December 23rd, 2010, and that is the frequency, Kenneth. Thank you for listening. Be safe. See you all tomorrow. Bye now. We'll